We're going to talk briefly about your own personal background, and then we'll move into the union.
All right.
So you were born when, where? Tell us a little bit about your community, your family.
Okay. See, I'm going to choke up now and get emotional. So I was born in California in the Bay Area in 1951, the oldest of three boys who were 2 years apart. And then my family moved to St. Louis, Missouri. It was in 1960. And in thinking about that, my father had a series of jobs and a series of stories that go along with those jobs, including working for the telephone company. So I used to pull that out on occasion that he worked for Pactel. We moved to St. Louis. So I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, because I'm there from 10 to 15, which I think of the formative, or 16, 17, the formative years. And growing up in the Midwest was a good thing, because had I grown up in New York City or the Bay Area, I would have been a sectarian radical of some sort, but never had to deal with those people, because in St. Louis, when we played kickball, there was four of us for Kennedy and 16 of them for Nixon. And so that was kind of like the community of growing up, but with parents who were left-wing parents and out of step with the community. One more story about that, which is not what you're here for. But one more story about that, which is I'm in fifth grade, fourth grade, and Castro's coming to the United States. And my friend Freddie Peel says to me, well, my dad would shoot him if he came down our street. So I go home, I talk to my mom, I said, hey, Freddie Peel's father would shoot Castro if he was on their street. What would you do? And my mom says, well, I'd invite him in for tea so he could talk. So I go back to school the next day and tell Freddie Peel, well, my mom would invite him in to talk. So then Freddie Peel and I had to have this big fight, and it was my last fight. I beat the shit out of him. And it was my last fight that I ever had, physical fight that I ever had to have, because who knows? He was down. I didn't know what to do next. Anyway, that's growing up in St. Louis. I leave St. Louis. I discovered St. Louis is parochial. We describe St. Louis as its ass is in the north and its face is the south, or vice versa. Face is north, ass in the south. Incorporates the worst of both cultures. So it was a good place to grow up for America.
Do you want to talk a little more about your parents' politics and how that affected you?
Sure. So my parents' politics were left-wing. My father grew up in the South. Integration was incredibly important to him. His statement would be that the communists cared about integration, so he joined with the communists in the 50s. By the mid-50s, they were disaffiliated, or I don't know even how deeply affiliated they were. And I never fully got those stories from my mother or my father, except for the fact they didn't like it by the mid-50s. So I'm 5 years old when they don't like it.
It being the Communist Party.
Yeah. But then, because the 50s were different, so they both came from middle class families. My grandma on my mom's side was a clerk in the army. Her husband died young. My mother lost her father and brother by the time she's 13. Brother died at the beginning of World War, not the beginning, in the middle of World War II, but in the States. And then on the father's side, so we were Jewish immigrants. My father's grandfather comes over to this country. His father, you know, works in the various grocery stores in Cleveland. They came from Cleveland, and they're all buried in Cleveland. And then the Jewish cemetery in Cleveland, with massive breaks from being Jewish, so that one of the many revolutions would have been going from Orthodox Jews to Reform Jews to nominal Jews. I was not ever bar mitzvahed or raised that way. Grandpa, story goes, liked to gamble and lost money to the mob, had to flee to the end of the earth. So in the 30s, ends up in Miami Beach, which is at the end of the road at that point. He grows into business there. He has a lumber yard. So all the mills in Miami, on South Beach, all the beautiful millwork, woodworking work comes out of his shops, he says. They were wealthy for the time. I mean, he owned a mill, but never super rich. The family owned the beach underneath the Fontainebleau Hotel, but Grandma didn't like sand being tracked into the living room, so they moved inland 5 miles, 1937 or something. So there's a series of stories like that. Or he had a contract to build barges during the war, and his claim was the congressman was crooked, or whoever, the contracting officer was crooked, but who knows. So he had to send a crew up to Cleveland or wherever the barges were being built to add a foot to each barge because he had lousy specs, so he lost money then. Only businessmen to lose money in the war.
So I'm going to pull you back from talking about
him.
Back to your own parents and...
Oh, so that's the milieu my father grew up in. Mm-hmm. He's chased out of Florida because he's trying to integrate the University of Florida in 1948 or 47 or some point. Ku Klux Klan comes to the house and talks to his father, who tells him, they're going to kill us if you don't leave.
So if your father doesn't leave.
If my dad doesn't leave, yeah.
What was his first name?
Daniel. Okay. Daniel Cole. So he leaves. Must have been 1940. I don't know which year. It's somewhere between 48 and 50. And they end up in California, where he then does a bunch of these kind of factory jobs. Worked in an auto factory for 5-6 years till the Fremont plant closed down. Drove a cab. Worst job he ever had, he would say, because he had to carry the drunks up to their wives' doorsteps. So when the Fremont plant shut down, it was the time that Sputnik had gone up from the Russians. There was lots of money to go back to school. So he went back to school with a plan to be an engineer. His claim, my hands sweat, so I couldn't make the drawings work. So he becomes a scientist, and then in 1959 moves to St. Louis for graduate studies with Barry Commoner and the Center for Environmental Studies that existed there. And that's what brought us to St. Louis then, so I'm 10 years old when we go to St. Louis.
And he was a professor then at WashU?
Well, he's a student then. He was a graduate student. He was a graduate student at WashU, and then at some point, 5 years later, maybe becomes a professor.
And your mother became an anthropologist?
So I'm 10, and so 3 years later, my mom's in school. She goes back to school as well when we're in St. Louis. 3 years later, she's pregnant with my baby sister, and within a year of that. So 4 years later, she gets her doctorate and then teaches at a small Catholic university called Webster College in St. Louis. And that was my first exposure to nuns would be. She invited colleagues from work over. I must be, 13 years old, because Martha was born. Yeah, 13, 14 years old. These three nuns walk into the house. And the first one looks exactly what you think a nun should look like, dour, skinny face, this, that, and the other. So the second one walks in, and she hops on top of our St. Bernard and says, giddy up, giddy up. And it was like my mind exploded. Like, this is not what I thought nuns were.
And what values do you think you got from your parents that then informed your work?
At CWI. So it was the unions were important. Caring was important. People were important. And they were particularly non-institutional. So I think there was a conflict between the individual and people versus big ideas. So they kind of scorned, this is why I describe it as, I'm glad I didn't grow up in New York. So they would have scorned the kind of the super ideological people who only cared about systems but never cared about the people. And they cared very much about individuals and people. So I think that element of caring comes from them. Social progressivism comes from them. But my generation was anti-war, And so for my dad, it was integration. So I was always, we're for integration. Yeah. But it wasn't a cause celeb for me. To me, it was the war, that environment. And then labor was always a theme underneath that, that labor was critically important and unions were critically important.
Okay, I'm going to come back to that, but I have one other question. You,
sure.
You mentioned that your family was Jewish, but not...
religious.
Not religious, and it sounds like not affiliated with any Jewish organizations.
That's correct.
And you didn't get Jewish education.
No. So my mom's family, she got brought up in New York City Ethical Society. And my dad was Cleveland Jewish... some kind of Orthodox background, because there's a Jewish cemetery in Cleveland and the headstones are in Hebrew.
So would you say that Jewish culture, history, values are part of your background and code, or no?
I would say they are, but for me it's a hidden. So I have to read about Jewish values and Jewish history to understand, that's where that comes from. So it was never explicit in my generation, meaning my brothers and me's upbringing.
And I'm going to jump to a topic we haven't talked about yet. Morty Barr was Jewish, pretty assimilated.
Right.
Larry Cohen was Jewish, very assimilated.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about, was there anti-Semitism during your years in CWA? If so, how was it expressed? If not?
So that's a funny question. Only funny because there was. The Jews were taking over the Union, and that was a bad thing. In the general ambience. But given my background and upbringing in St. Louis, I was totally mostly oblivious to it. I do remember at some point Doug Thompson, who I liked, who's Caribbean, African, not so, I guess he's brought up in the United States, but anyway, he came from New York. He was a telephone guy. No, was he a telegraph or Anyway, it doesn't matter. So Doug Thompson,
who eventually became an assistant in District 2.
Right. And then he went back to Belize and opened up a resort, and his brother was like, a big shot in the economics department.
Economics department of?
The state of Belize. Yeah, the secretary of the economy kind of level. Anyway, so apparently, I think he wrote a paper at some point talking about the Jews taking over, some kind of external threat of them taking over the Union. But mostly I was oblivious to... there's never any, I got Dan Boone would tell anti-Jewish jokes. Dan Boone was an assistant from District 7. But it was the kind of jokes that growing up I didn't take it as Jewish jokes. You could replace, in the joke, you could replace the Jew with a Polak or with the WAP. You could replace any ethnicity in the joke, which is how I heard those kinds of jokes as opposed to understanding or feeling, wait a minute, this is really virulent and bad stuff. It was just, again, this is the St. Louis elements of water off a duck's back. It doesn't mean anything because it had no meaning to me. Maybe it had meaning to them, had meaning more broadly, but I was oblivious. So that was kind of how I suffered through it.
Were there many Jews in CWA?
Not that I knew of. I mean, there might have, the story had been is that the telephone company liked to hire Catholic girls for the operators because they knew how to obey the rules and they were well-behaved. And then certainly on the East Coast, it was Irish and Catholic, kind of was a great craft job. And so it was a family thing. Burns an Irish Catholic. So it had on the East Coast anyway, felt it was a Catholic thing, Catholic industry, so to speak. So no, I don't think I don't know if there were no Jews, but there was no Jewish presence that I was aware of until Morty comes up. And then Morty is totally transformational as a character within CWA both in his self-awareness of who he is, and then B, what he ended up doing for the Union.
So look, we got up to you talking about for your generation and for you, the key politicizing event was the war in Vietnam. You left St. Louis to go to college. I don't know where you went.
So
talk about that politicization.
Okay, so
your post high school and your politicization.
Okay, so two more stories. One story about high school would be I played soccer. My mom wouldn't let me play football. It was too dangerous, so we played soccer. And St. Louis was a massive soccer town. The Catholic youth organizations had 50,000 kids. This is in 65. Anyway, playing soccer. So it was massive, and all the Catholic high schools were real powerhouses in soccer. So I played soccer, and my friend was Matt Filla. And so the contradiction for me would be we play soccer. Sitting in a locker room, Matt would say, let's go out and punch the shit out of those hippies who were leafleting against the Vietnam War. It's like, what the fuck do you want to do that for? And it's like that was my, again, contradiction growing up. So high school, my junior year of high school, I was tardy 10 times, and they told me they'd suspend me when I was tardy 11th time. So then I realized, well, if I just don't show up at all, I won't be tardy for the 11th time. So I would walk to school. I'd be late. It was a mile and a half uphill both ways in the snow. I'd walk to school. I'd meet my friend who was going work-study, and we would go play tennis. And I would go back to school for my fifth period Russian class because I liked her for some reason because she really cared. And then school would be over after the fifth and sixth period. Then I go play tennis again. So I get the report card for that semester, and I've been absent 35 days. And it's clear I'm not going to make it through high school to my parents. I'm a junior at this point. So they were worried about me, rightly so. And then my younger brother escaped with drugs. I didn't do a lot of drugs like he did. But, you know, something would have been in the cards of self-destructive or something, some kind of rebellion. I don't know what it would have been. So they looked for an alternative high school for me. There was a Quaker high school in Iowa called Scattergood. They called them and they said, we only take people for 2 years, but try this new place up in Canada, Argenta. So that was a good thing to do because it would also set me up to avoid the draft. So we went... So I went to the last year of high school to a 20-person Quaker school in the middle of nowhere in British Columbia. As I like to say, I graduated in the top third of my class because there was only 10 people graduating. And then from Canada, came back to the United States, to St. Louis, worked, you know, for 3 weeks in a furniture factory, changing pine pieces to walnut TV benches. And then the revolution had come because somebody picked up a piece of wood and whacked the supervisor. And then the other. And if you got to work late, as in the finishing department, if you got work late, you had to sit over the sealer vat. So it's this massive unventilated room. And 20 minutes into it, you were as high as a kite. You couldn't even find your feet to walk outside for breaks. And then my father probably helped me find a job with the Committee for Environmental Information, where I was a research assistant. Oh, and then I went to school. I was in school for a year and a half as well. And then I dropped out. I got drafted. I was sick when I got drafted, so I got my notice to report to the physical, but they didn't know what I had at the time. They thought I had leukemia. Then from leukemia, it went to hepatitis, and that's when the draft notice hit. And then, so the doctor wrote a nice note to the draft notice board. He's too sick to show up. They said, come back in 6 months. 6 months go by. I never hear from the draft board again, so someone must have stamped my file 4-H, which is permanent health, as opposed to 1-Y, which is temporary health deferment. But I drop out of school anyway, and I meet these people in St. Louis who are Brazilians. They're friends of mine who do occupational health and safety work. And they say, you haven't seen the world unless you've been to Rio de Janeiro. And, you know, I've been to St. Louis, I've been to Canada, but I've never seen the world, they say. So I look at a map and I say, well, geez, if I learn Spanish, I can go to 13 countries as opposed to Portuguese, where I can only go to one. I had no idea of the history of French imperialism, or if I'd learned French, I could have gone to Africa and Southeast Asia. So I go to Mexico with my family for the summer because they were learning Spanish someplace. And then I stay at the University of Mexico's School for Foreign Students for a semester. And after that's done, and while I'm there, my plan is to go to Tierra del Fuego, the southern tip of South America. And then while I'm there, the coup in Chile happens. And there's this massive demonstration in Mexico, the likes of which I've never seen, in terms of how they do a march, in terms of that the crowd would march, people would hold the march for a while, and everybody would run forward. So it had this wave effect, which was very, very dramatic.
1973.
72 or 3. 73? All right. So the first I can go now is to Peru. I go to Peru. I end up, there's some funny stories about that, which are probably not relevant. But I do meet British people who hand me over to the British Peace Corps people, and I end up doing odd jobs at British Peace Corps postings. So in Peru, you would go from Lima to the Central Highlands and down the Central Highlands to Cusco. So I ended up in the second stop of that place at a hospital, helped carry a pregnant woman once to be in labor, for example. And then from there, went down to the end of the road towards the jungle. From there, I was on a boat, which time gets measured now in terms of hours instead of miles. So it's a half a day trip down the river, then it's a 4-hour walk into the jungle. Anyway, so that's how I spent time and saw incredible things, as you can imagine. The one memorable story might be, I'm in what's called the eyebrow of the jungle, so it's a little bit above jungle and not in the highlands. And there's a family that's clearly from the highlands, because the women have, they're not called costumes, but they would be called something politically correct.
They're indigenous.
Indigenous clothing, or indigenous what? Indigenous, anyway, costumes. And indigenous.
Clothes.
Clothes. Symbols of their self-identity. Anyway. Which is clearly inappropriate for the heat of the jungle. But there they are. They're hacking with machetes, right? And the trees are, bigger than I am, wide. And with machetes, they're clearing land. And And there's the father, the mother. There's a 9-year-old. And then there's a 4-year-old, 3-year-old, 2-year-old. And so it's real clear between the nine-year-old came with them when they started to hack out this little farm. And then, the 8-year-old, 7-year-old, 6-year-old, and 5-year-old all died. And then the 4-year-old, they finally had enough established. It takes 5 years to establish the cocoa plants for cash crop and enough subsistence growth that the 4-year-old, 3-year-old, and 2-year-old could survive.
So you were in South America for a period.
Yeah,
and then then you came back to the U.S.?
Then I come back to the U.S. and go back to school.
Where?
At the University of Texas, and spend 2 years there, and then I'm finished with school.
And majored in?
Economics. So Why economics? So why economics? I've been to Latin America. I wanted to understand it in a bigger context. So I wanted a Latin American studies program. There were two, one at Texas, one at Wisconsin. It's a different era. It's late spring, I'll come back. And I apply to both programs, and I hear back from Texas first. I would have preferred to go to Wisconsin. Nobody in their right mind would ever go to Texas. Maureen and I, my wife, took a trip down there to Texas, decided it was okay, even though the air conditioning was called refrigeration. And so did Latin American studies, and at the end of my 2 years of school, I could take either a math course or a political science course and either become an economist or become a Latin American studyist. Chose the math course because that was easier than, that was anyway, I like math. So that's how I became an economist. I mean, economics was always important, but it was more political economy was important.
And were you politically active at that point? Were you ever in SDS?
There was, no. I mean, there would have been, I'm trying to think. I don't think organizationally. There was a Latin American Studies. It would have been international, so I was tied in to the international Latin American Studies group. We may have protested something, but there was nothing really organizational. And then I was working in the library to a little bit. I mean, 15, 20 hours a week in the library and then going to school. So that's when we talked about it. We talked big theories of political change, but it was a coffee shop, non-organizational engagement.
So I am going to skip over. I know you did some jobs around international issues.
Mm-hmm, right.
I'm going to skip over that and jump to how you came to work for CWA.
So
let me stop. Jeff, did you have any questions at this point about that background?
No, I'd like to get the CWA genesis here.
Okay,
sorry.
Yeah. I'm sitting here regretting that I never asked you about your backstory over all these years.
Yeah,
this is fascinating. You could go on with this the whole time, but it wouldn't fit the mission, I think.
Right. Okay, so CWA. So as Debbie said, I was in Washington, D.C. working for nonprofits. Had worked for one about development policy and change, where I wrote about runaway shops and how that was the flip side of underdevelopment in Latin America, the destruction of Latin American economies, that it was the same political problem. Worked for SANE for a little bit about conversion and the military economy, and then saw an ad. During SANE in the military economy was tied in a little bit, but not much, with the machinists, who had a guy named Dick Greenwood, who was phenomenal. And but then saw an ad in the newspaper looking for a research person. There were still classified ads in newspapers back in that day, and applied for the job. Went in and interviewed for it, and it saw on the whiteboard, which they had listed all the applicants, or the bulletin board. Anyway, the chalkboard? I think it was a whiteboard. Yeah, new innovation, a whiteboard. And I look at all the people, and I say, oh my God, those people are much smarter, much better, much more accomplished than I am. And a lot of them spent their careers in Washington too. But because I had done environmental things, and so knew a little bit something about energy conservation, and at that time the Bell System was interested in energy conservation was a big deal in 1980, which is when I'm applying for the job. This is my story anyway. Because I think I had that background, they picked me so that I could pick up that little bit of staffing work for Glenn Watts, who was the president at the time, for him to go to and be engaged with the Bell System people or whoever he was being engaged with on the issues of energy conservation. And so I think that was it. Once I'm in CWA.
In the research department
as a research assistant.
And that's Ronnie Straw.
Ronnie Straw was the research director. And there were 5, 6, 7 of us there. Anyway.
And what was the role of the research department then?
Well, the key role of the research department was to support Bell System bargaining. So that was the key thing. And once every 3 years, it was very... So this is 1980. So by 1980, you know, achieved national bargaining in 74. 77 is the first round. 1980 is the second round. And so it was important. The research department plays a role in pulling together lots of information, which I don't know whether anybody ever looked at, but certainly made the point that, you know, there's a lot of background here. And for certain kinds of things may have been important. In terms of, you know, here's some options or here's some, you know, breadth of ideas or kernels of ideas. And so 1980, I'm not sure I would say is in 1979, there had been this kind of massive explosion with operators and job stress. And so in 1980, and there's no hint of divestiture really, we negotiate something. The one-day strike, anyway, there's a one-day strike, which was rare for the time, negotiate a series of programs in 1980, we, meaning the CWA, about quality of work life, about technology change, and about the changing jobs, job evaluation. And that triumvirate of programs tried to mimic in the private sector in the United States kind of what social democracy and what unions were achieving in Europe on a broader scale.
And what was the, I know you've talked to me a lot about the 1980 bargaining and that this could have been the beginnings of a union having a larger role in issues that are not typically the area in which unions have a role. So going beyond bargaining over wages and benefits and a bigger picture of influencing working conditions. And you've now said it was an attempt to begin to have more of a role like in Europe. Where did that come from? Did that come from the president? Did that come from where did, because you bargained language over tech change committees, you bargained language, as you said, quality of work life, which we'll talk about in a second. That's almost in a category of its own. Job evaluation. And this was also the year in which the operators finally got language of protections against monitoring, the worst abuses of monitoring. It was 1980. And as you're right, 1979 was the big national mobilizations around job pressures, which really came out of the female operators. And a long campaign.
So I'm not sure where it came from. I think part of it might have been the environment and how we parsed apart the different elements of it. I'm not sure how that happened in the way in which it happened or who did it. I mean, Glenn ends up being incredibly thoughtful as a person, I think underestimated in some ways. And I never had any dealings with him. So, I mean, he's at the top and I'm at the bottom of the hierarchy. So I really have no sense. But he was incredibly thoughtful as a person. It was a different time in the sense that there were lots of tripartite, that was a big word, tripartite groupings to look at different kinds of problems, be it healthcare, be it the international order, be it the work and the evolution of the economy. And so I think there was much more sense of business and labor. Labor is big enough still to make a difference. And we're on the decline, but we're not so declined that we don't have any influence.
We meaning?
Labor.
Labor.
We meaning
because
labor.
Because for CWA, 1980, would you call that almost the apex?
No, I'd say it's 84 or 83 or 86.
Well, divestiture comes in 84.
Right. So, I mean, so we continued. So my view of the 80s is that, that because of who we were and how change was a little bit slower, but the nature of competition and just what it anyway took, we didn't get hit as badly as trucking. We didn't get hit as badly later on as the airlines. And we, my view was, and we weren't subject to NAFTA, third world kind of manufacturing pressures, except in Western Electric, which collapses earlier. So we survived it, I think, better, or negotiated through it better. So I don't consider, well, so I don't consider 1980 the apex. It was, certainly was the end of the golden, 83 in my mind, is the end of the golden era where, you know, we don't have national bargaining anymore. And it is totally clear, although at one level it doesn't make any sense, totally clear. You bargain for 500,000 people at once. It's a different deal than bargaining 25, 30,000, even, you know, 100,000, a very different deal. And the nature of the Bell system also was totally familial in the sense that everybody knew everybody. And so Ivan Seidenberg, the CEO of 9X, works in a crew in New York plant. The story goes the New York plant guys covered for him so he could get his education. So he knew what they were like. Wives or husbands were top executives or brother-in-law. I mean, everybody knew people throughout the system, which I think also changed the nature of conflict and
lessened conflict when you say change the nature.
Yeah, lessened how that conflict was going to manifest itself. I mean, so it was hard to call the boss for many people. I mean, in one way, it's really easy because the boss on a crew, particularly was a jerk, is an asshole. But on the other hand, if the boss wasn't an asshole and was in fact your sister, it was much harder to be angry at the family member. It changed my view anyway. It changed the nature of what conflict was. It was more interwoven as a company. This is 1980, right? More interwoven as a company than it is later on, when people from outside the industry come over, take it over, find all the slack in the system, and want to just kind of make it an economic entity. And it was just, and one more thing, and it had, as a system, it also had a mission, right? So it's, my view of the mission was encapsulated. There's a picture of a lineman struggling through a blizzard in Nebraska, and he's putting back up the lines because it, you know, it had meaning, which the work had meaning. It didn't mean that everybody was gaming the system at the same time. So it's this contradiction between everybody gaming the system and how can I make my life better, or, you know, the crew's life better, and this other mission of, or get paid to overtime to do the mission work, which is providing an essential service for America. So there's a bigger, higher kind of part of what the telephone company was, or what they're, anyway.
So before we go on, Jeff, does that, George's description of a family feeling within Bell and the Bell system and that tamped down certain kinds of conflict between the workers and managers resonate with you?
Yeah, I think it absolutely did. I mean, it was a very paternalistic arrangement that existed in the Bell system, you know, and obviously a big portion of that came from, you know, them being a monopoly. And, you know, there was really no real contention between the cost of providing the service and the wages that we were paid, because they'd get that back in their rates every year when they'd go back to their local commissions. It was definitely that feeling when I arrived in 71 and for the first 10 years that I was there.
So when you were talking with Larry about how in your local you developed mobilization, that was in the 80s, not the 70s?
No, that was the 70s.
So you lived that contradiction?
No, I see the contradiction, but part of my push towards a mobilization type of model really came out of my own personal naivete. I didn't know any better that, you know, that some of these structures that were already in place within the Bell system, at least within Ohio Bell at that time, were longstanding and, you know, just that's the way things were. And so, you know, I sort of rebelled against that and it resonated with a number of people. I mean, it was, as I mentioned, our first real conflict came for service reps who on Monday mornings had to take their break at 10 minutes after 8, 10 minutes after they arrived on the job. And it was like, well, you know, paternalistic law says that's the way it has to be. And it's been that way for 40 years. I don't know how many years before that. And so you know, we just pushed back. But that didn't take away from the sense that they still felt very paternalistic. They still felt this overall sense that this was a good, safe place to be. I got hired at the phone company because my mother said, the guy across the street works at the phone company. You should apply there. That's a good job. You can retire from that job. Yeah. And so that was the sense that you went in. And in 1971, you could get hired anywhere. I mean, in Cleveland, you could have been in an auto plant. You could have been in the steel mill. You could have been in any kind of machine shop. I mean, there were jobs all over the place. And you know, the phone company had that resonance that this is a nice, safe place to land.
So, George, let's jump to 1984.
Well, the other footnote I want to just make for Ohio Bell is they never had a grievance procedure. So either the issue was important enough to strike about or do something about, or it wasn't. So I think that also would have been part of the
Ohio. And we talked at length about that it was, you know, we were unique in the Bell system. Right. That, you know, we did not have arbitration, and so, you know, conducting a grievance strike was our only option to get a grievance resolved, where the company just flat out said no.
So I'm going to jump up to 1984, the breakup of the Bell system, and that was big change. Talk about it.
So let me digress first about me. And the research department between 1980 and 1984. So I'm junior in the research department. The raison d'etre of the research department is to provide support for Bell bargaining. GT is a far cry second, even though there might have been 80,000 members back then, maybe even 100. Anyway, 80,000. So I end up being assigned the dredge work of the research department, which is support organizing. And so I'm supporting organizing in whatever forms that means. And then that means in 1981 or two, I forget which, Cohen in New Jersey, the big state workers campaigns take off. And so I do a big fat paper about the lagging wages in the public sector in New Jersey, which they can wave around. That's what I said. I think it could have been a cover sheet and 50 blank pieces of paper. So it was the key purpose was that it be waved around. But there's lots of words and charts and graphs in there. And then worked with them or celebrated, you know, their organizing drive and knew a lot of the local people who were on the committee there as a result of that work. And then supported their bargaining. And again, this was all because I was junior in the research department doing the unimportant work of the union, which was okay. And then ended up not so much, but doing some work on the field organizing campaigns, which were different. Anyway, in the public sector in Ohio before we got out of it. And I go back one more step just to say it. In 1980, Watts hires an external organizing department, and that's seen as a controversial move amongst the CWA board. And it's debated that this is a controversial thing, that A, it's an organizing department, but B, he's bringing in outsiders to run it. He's bringing outsiders to run it, and brought in some SEIU people to run it, and it was a big deal in 1980.
So who was the head of it?
So that was Bob Muscat was the head of it, and then Ken Margolis and John Tanner were the other two that Bob brought with him over from SEIU. And they had huge conflict with the district structure, particularly Marty Hughes in Ohio, about, you know, the shape of that organizing campaign and who was going to be in charge of it and who's going to control it and blah, 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 which I didn't know all the details of. But anyway, so that's the early 80s. So then you have to remind me whether we have 83 bargaining,
Right.
where we build on some of the things, but we know that divestiture is offing. I think that it's in the, I don't remember exactly.
Divestiture was the consent decree was 1982.
82
So you knew what was
was
going to
coming.
be happening.
Right.
You knew that AT&T was going to become the Long Lines and the Western Electric and Bell Labs,
Right.
and you knew that there were going to be seven regional Bell operating
Right.
companies. And
Right.
I think one of the issues in 83 was had to do with what was going to happen to the pensions and what would happen to people in choosing which company they'd go to and
Right.
those kind of issues.
Right.
And there was a strike, I think, in
There's
83.
there was a 26-day strike, which I went back and read about, but not enough to know the details. So 83, we know divestiture is coming. As you just said, people are upset about and having to make, life-changing decisions, which company I'm going to work for. There's a Well, there was wrong. I think we thought that there's going to be more work in the information side of the industry, which was more heavily deregulated. And so that was seen as a good thing. AT&T raised itself up as we're really going to be the golden childs, and the bells are going to be pedestrian. And then,
Information side meaning computers, right?
well, no, information side at that point really meant the technician, premise technician, people who went into the house and installed telephones. So we had 40, 50,000 people who installed telephones in 19, in the early 80s. And they worked under each Bell System contract. So there's, as many as there were. And then John Agee had to consolidate that into one contract, which was called AT&T Information Systems, or ATIS contract. And that was full of fights like whose snow policy is better, Ohio's or Michigan, or was the kind of the classic case. But massive trade-offs at that level. But X number of years later, there's no one left in that business. So that was, as a business, I think we thought it would survive better than it did. And I'd have to look back to see. NCR, I think, is purchased by AT&T, but I don't think that comes till 1990. But anyway, that was the trajectory that people thought would happen with AT&T. So it was a miscalculation, in some ways. Well, period. So that bargaining, so yeah, so I would say that bargaining would be the apex. That would be the inflection point where we hold our own just fine, I think, anyway. It's clear from that bargaining, Barr wrote about it in his book, at the first, this is the first time you have all the different Bell guys at the table who have interests and are beating their chests about how we're going to take away this, we're going to take away that, we're going to change this, we're going to change that.
You mean the management side?
Management side, yeah. So that whoever's managing bargaining for AT&T had their hands full in terms of the, they still controlled it, which ultimately is why they could settle it. But they had more pressures, I think, on their side than they'd ever had before in terms of, we overpay in the South, we overpay in, US West, wherever we overpay, whatever it is was out of kilter because it was a national contract. Those pressures manifest themselves in 83, but get resolved. And I don't think there was any major concessions in 83 that I recall anyway. I'd have to go back and read it. But I don't remember it as a concession contract or a change contract even for that matter. But forward progress stops. We still have the programs. We're still, so going back to the European programs of quality work life and tech change, et cetera, we still have those programs. We never quite realized the potential on things like tech change. It really is too big and so outside the mold of what is U.S. bargaining and so under-resourced compared to what the Europeans could do that we on our side couldn't keep up and couldn't or didn't have enough muscle to insist. But I mean, it was a time where automatic call distributors are new technology at that time. So it's like that they're placing an automatic. So in terms of job pressures and job design, if you when you had switches that couldn't that only could allocate work in a small geographic area, you needed lots of offices in small geographic areas. The change when the automatic call distributor comes in and the computing and ultra-fast digital signaling comes in, you can put a call distributor in Albuquerque that controls calls from Albuquerque to Salt Lake City to Denver to various areas in around. So all of a sudden, the dynamics around how A, operator work, which is changing from other reasons, but B, service rep work is changing as well, versus C, the economics for the company in terms of small offices and big offices starts to change. So we almost, we could get in front of it a little bit, and we could talk about, well, how are we going to mitigate that change? But we couldn't get to a place where we could control that, how, what is the next generation of automatic call distributor going to look like, right? Or who are the people who are writing that code? And can we write code that is different? We would say, well, we should be able to write code so that someone does, gets a 1 second or 2 second break before the next call comes in, or we should be able to, anyway, we should be able to do different things, but we never really had the ability to do those things in terms of in terms of designing new technology. And then in the in that same period in the 80s, the internet as a switching system is invented. And I remember we knew it was important, and we knew digital switching was important. And it was inside AT&T Communications. And in fact, it was inside Gerald Souder's local. From Cincinnati, I think, or wherever he was from. But so had a conversation at that point with Irvine. This is really important new technology. We need to be ahead of it. This is going to be the controlling technology of the new economy.
Are you talking about packet switching?
I don't know what I'm talking about. But yeah, I think I'm talking about packet switching.
When you said internet, because digital switching.
Digital switching wasn't happening, and so this was, yeah.
So going from analog to digital.
This must have been digital and packets, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the people setting up the digital lines for packets. So the people setting up the lines for packet switching, right? So you need a transmission line to have your packets flow. So even if you have routers on either end of the digital line, something has to transmit that, and it has to know, here's a list of routers where it could go.
You have to go to fiber, right?
Well, but at that point, part of it was fiber and part of it was micro towers. So it was developing.
And when you said Gerald Souder's local,
yeah.
Where is this? And is this AT&T long
lines?
It's
an AT&T. It's a 50, so it must be 40-50. It must be a 50 local anyway in Cincinnati.
Okay.
I think. So we knew that this is happening. Can we do anything about this? And Jim says, well, we tried.
But
Jim Irvine says.
The vice president head of AT&T.
Right.
CWA's bargaining unit with AT&T.
AT&T. Right. We did, but what AT&T did is you had these guys who were communication technicians, Comtechs, who are the people who would technologically set up these lines. And so on Friday, they were Comtechs. Management came in and said, well, we're setting up a new thing now. And on Monday, you're going to be management. So you're going to have to wear a tie to work. And you're going to get a different title. Same desk, same job, same person, right? And they're now management, so stripping work from the bargaining unit on the top end, which is controlling the new economy, or it's going to control the new economy because it's very early. Well, can't we convince them that, you should be in the union? And I don't know how systematic it was, the work, but there was at least one conversation or two conversations which come back, no, they don't want it. They like the tie. They like to be management. They want to be management. And so that is a dynamic at that point. Was a reality.
Do you know what point this was, either of you?
It's got to be in the early 80s. I mean, it's got to be, because Irvine, I have to think when Irvine becomes vice president. Well, he was a national director before then. I'd have to look and see. I don't remember, but it had to be early 80s. Yeah, because it's before. So in my mind, in my career, Jobs with Justice is 87.
Mm-hmm.
And my work changes dramatically at that point. So it's pre-87. And I think it's probably after, between 84 and 87 then, because probably after divestiture. But we were doing a lot of work on technology in the, 82 to 85, if you're trying to parse it out. Work, we discover automatic call distributors. We discover this new thing that's going to be the internet, packet switching and digital switching and digital transmission. So I think that's the time frame it had to be.
So
and then that same, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, you're not.
That same dynamic then continues forever. So meaning forever, meaning, even 10 years ago, let's think this is 2010, Ralph Mailey is fighting about engineering associates at AT&T, big bunch of them, the top craft in the union, and what their work is, and then AT&T peeling off pieces of that work and taking it and making it managerial work as well. So there was always an erosion, conscious erosion at the top by AT&T, by management, whichever company it was, to split off, skim off top craft work, or the most, I guess you'd call it most sophisticated work. But
and did this happen before the competitive pressures?
Yeah.
In other words, before, during the monopoly era, if there were tech
so
change, the union would get that work, and it was more planned and gradual?
Well, I think that's a good question. It would be interesting to see. I'm sure there was struggle over that, where it belonged. There was clear delineation in the minds of management and labor relations about what was traditional telephone work and what wasn't. So there was this very fuzzy line in our minds of traditional telephone work and why aren't these functions traditional? And on the management side, it was very clear, no, that's not traditional. So all the salary-graded people at Western, salary-graded was a professional set of titles in Bell Labs. That was not traditional telephone work. So I think in the management's mind, traditional telephone work is, operator service reps, craft who deal with customers. Whether you're a service rep who deals with business, that might not be traditional telephone work. Some places it obviously was because we represented those people. So where they drew those lines of what was traditional, they kept drawing a box of what was traditional work and shoving it in there. And then we wanted to expand that, and that we flows from Danny Fatanti, particularly, and out of the Southwest Bell and Vic Crawley, their work around graining card check. And the language around card check speaks to traditional telecom, that the people who are, I'd have to read it again to make sure, but the people who are subject to the card check agreement are traditional telephone work people. And then we'd have to have fights about what does that mean. So under the rubric of traditional telephone work, people in the wireless industry who did installed equipment, who sold equipment, customer service stuff, that was traditional work. But we wanted to take it up a step to the programming people, and that was not traditional work in the management's mind, so that the card check agreement would not apply to them.
Okay, let me just jump in. I think you've jumped.
I have jumped, yeah.
Southwestern, the fight for
card
check neutrality in Southwestern Bell Wireless. And you're saying one would have to read the agreement, but you're saying you think that there was in that agreement covered titles that were similar to...
It wasn't just titles. That's my point. My point wanted to be is that the big deal between CWA and telephone company would have been you, the union, can represent traditional telephone workers in a whatever that meant.
Mm-hmm.
And as that boundary changes, what does work mean?
Mm-hmm.
They drew a line which said, no, the internet and packet switching and that's not traditional work. Mm-hmm. That's new work. But the flip side is when we got to the wireless industry, they were okay with defining as traditional work because I guess they'd worked out a system where they knew the system worked. You know, salespeople are traditional work. People who are installing equipment are traditional work. And there's a level of traditional work that we're okay with the union. We can live with the union doing that work.
Well, it took a fight of 5 years in wireless.
Right, but then you hit the point where you're able to make a compromise, and the compromise is traditional work is okay, but we're not going to blur the line of what is.
Okay.
There's a cap. There's a technological cap, where as technology begins to change a lot, right, there was a very hard cap that they were not willing to move, they, company, were not willing to move beyond. And we were not able to mobilize people or people in those jobs at the top, above the cap, by and large, with a couple of exceptions, were not willing to mobilize themselves or organize themselves to say, no, we want to be in the union, right? We're happy to be above the cap, and we're not like those union people. We're not traditional telephone workers.
Well, I think...
And to be fair, there was some of that pre-divestiture as well. I mean, there were engineering titles, mm-hmm. marketing titles, right. where, you know, they, as you described, those people in those jobs were enamored with the thought of being management versus a craft job or in a union. And so it was easy to sort of peel some of them off over the years and erode those. John Ryan, his job title was marketing representative, and over time, I think there were maybe a half a dozen left in the whole state,
right.
As they eroded those away.
Right.
And the other thing about the card check is we can't minimize the regulatory pressure that was placed and that really made that possible.
Right.
It was less about, you know, okay, that does fit in the telephone mold,
right.
and this doesn't,
right.
as they needed our help. And,
absolutely.
And we weren't going to offer it to them without some quid pro quo.
Right. But if we had demanded even a bigger quid pro quo,
sure.
we wouldn't have gotten it. That was what I wanted the point to be, was on the technological
right.
side. And the managerial side, they were unbending, unyielding on that point.
But I think what you've moved into then is a discussion of there was, as... the digital and the packet switching and DSL technology became a bigger part. And I think one of the roles that you played and others was seeing what's the future. Now, let's not just bargain about the past right. or right. even the present, but where is the industry going and right. how do we bargain for it? Right. So there was a lot of push to negotiate language that gave us the union jurisdiction over new work. And I'm thinking particularly about some of the 9X contracts. And it was very detailed,
mm-hmm.
the agreements about new work, and lots of debates about
right.
where is the demarc point,
right.
which I don't understand at all. But... Do you want to talk at all about that, or is it too vague in your memory, which is perfectly legit?
Yeah, it is and it isn't. Let me just think for a minute. So to Jeff's point, there was still massive regulatory importance to telephone companies in the 80s.
Particularly Bell companies.
Well, yeah. AT&T
also, because AT&T is now competing. It's regulated by the FCC, which is still regulating AT&T in order to minimize its power so that the new entrants, MCI and Sprint, can
right.
succeed.
Right, exactly.
So there's...
And at that point, long-distance telephone revenues are huge to different companies. There's fights about who's going to get the long distance revenues, and the Bell companies want to be in the long distance market, and AT&T doesn't want them in there. And so there's
they're not allowed in it.
Yeah, but there was a time where they can then apply to be in it, They
Oh, you're jumping way ahead.
Way ahead, yeah. Anyway, but to your point, yes. But I was yes.
That's after the Telecom Act of 96 that the bells could apply.
Right.
To go
Is that
into,
right?
Yeah, there was yeah, a time. Absolutely. Between divestiture sure. and 84.
84 and 96 is only 12 years. Anyway, so yes, so the baby bells were still very dependent upon the decisions made at state level public service commissions. And our influence in the different public service commissions varied significantly. And we had, in some surprising places, we had more power than in others. So I think I remember in the Southwest, either New Mexico or Arizona. In Arizona, there was an elected PSC, and we actually would play a role in those elections. And so we had more say in Arizona than you would have thought that a union like us would have been able to have.
I think Pennsylvania was another place we had a lot of influence through individual relationships.
Right. There was massive effort in Pennsylvania, the political effort, to sustain those Democrat, Republican, didn't matter. We just care about the PSC and what's the PSC going to be able to deliver or not deliver for us and how to forge a either coalition or a smokescreen of a coalition but a theory that aligns our work with consumers' work and benefiting consumers. But it was in the Verizon. So what's ironic about this, I can't remember exactly when the GTE, let's back up. There's a set of mergers that start taking place, right? So you got Bell Atlantic South and Bell Atlantic North, which is Bell Atlantic and 9X that are merging. And each of those merger discussions was tremendous leverage for the union to make guarantees.
1997.
This is jumping way ahead.
But it's important. This is the year after the Telecom Act when you have, then cable can get into telephone markets, right. Local bells can get into long distance can get into local,
right.
And a response of the bell companies then is, we've got to merge.
Okay, so that's what triggers the mergers. Okay, so.
So Bell Atlantic 9X
is the first one. So
think about that. 1989 and the strike.
Right. That's got so many things to think about. So the point I was going to make about the 97 timeframe then and the 9X Bell Atlantic mergers, the key thing, which is kind of contraindicated, we care about the future, we're going to protect the past. And this was Morty's genius. We're going to protect the past. And he was able to draw a circle around offices that you couldn't be forced transferred beyond that very small circle. And so in terms of job protections, it was enormous. And so that's looking to the past, right? So it's looking to the past. Well, it's dealing with the future, but it's protecting people in the past, in a past way.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but that was jumping forward. So jumping backward then to, I think it was the 93 agreement. I'm not sure it was the 93 or the 92 or the 90, which agreement in the 90s it was. But we knew about the importance of mobility. We knew about the coming importance of fiber optics. And we knew related to fiber optics and DSL was going to be new technologies that were going to be displaced through the network. We knew, too, that the possibilities for subcontracting were substantial. And so we formulated an approach which tried to, one, gain exclusive recognition, knowing that the exclusivity, which was A, rare, but B, how important it could be when you had it. And then C, we probably made too long a list of technologies because we weren't totally clear on what we wanted and didn't want. But the key one would have been then kind of fiber optics. And we knew that fiber optics to the home or fiber optics in the network were all things. Fiber was going to be the new copper. And if we could hang on to the big reach, was anything related to fiber was going to be union work. And so the thinking at the time would have been, that's even going to be wireless stuff because it's not all the central offices are going to be connected with fiber. And so if we can get the fiber and everything that's related to it as union work, we'll have made this big stride. That was the idea back in the early 90s. And so there's lots of language about that. And what we end up with is exclusive representation and then this long list that you mentioned about different kinds of work that is going to be ours to do. What they did, and
who's they?
The company, 9X. Yeah, it was 9X Management at the time. We had gotten ourselves positioned in the bargaining, give and take, that this was what we were talking about. We were talking about our proposal, which was somewhat rare, because we were pushing the envelope with our proposal as opposed to responding to their proposals. And in their first responses to our proposal, they incorporated, in management's view, too much of our language. So we were in good place there. And then we didn't know at the time either that this is a different, that the level of acquisitions was going to change as well. We had no, we didn't forecast GTE and Bell Atlantic and 9X were going to become one. It was just kind of beyond the scope of what we thought. So we thought, or I thought, they're going to, little companies. NCR was the biggest, and that was a $10 billion company. It wasn't, was it $10 billion? I'm getting my dates confused here.
We're very
confused.
NCR was it?
In the 90s.
I don't know if it was late 80s. I believe it was late 80s.
Late 80s, 90s. Okay.
And this was... We should clarify, because you kind of mushed it together.
I definitely mushed.
AT&T has after divestiture, has this vision that it is going to become the place in which computing and communications come together.
Right.
And they're allowed into computing at divestiture, something they'd been barred of before that. And NCR, so they purchase NCR.
Right.
And the way I see it is in the 80s, AT&T, and I think this is Bob Allen at this point as the CEO, is struggling to figure out what is the business plan for AT&T. And they buy NCR. And CWA has a big fight over representing NCR, which we can talk about.
Right.
And then after a few years, AT&T sells NCR, which is another example. And the competitive pressures are huge. AT&T is shedding 100,000 jobs.
Right.
So we're preserving our wages and benefits, fighting over health care already, but preserving them basically. But the issue is really job security. People are traveling all over the country to save their seniority, to save their job. And that, I think, becomes the focus of AT&T bargaining, where there's a lot of bargaining around, SIPs and VIPs and things like that. And retraining. And in 89, there's the alliance negotiated so that people can get paid to retrain, even to leave the company. In the 80s, the local companies, which employ more people, of more of our members, there's seven RBACs. Competition is cream skimming some of the business, but it's not hitting the consumer at all. And so it's much more stable. We still represent about two-thirds of the people at the Bell companies. And, of course, I came in 92, but this is when I think the wall-to-wall becomes important because there's this sense that both the Bells and AT&T, as they're moving into different businesses, whatever they may be, sometimes purchasing them, sometimes going overseas, that they're creating these new subsidiaries as non-union. So the fight that you were talking about, which was over job titles, as I recall, and this is where wall-to-wall came in, was also a fight over getting representation in these new subsidiaries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm not sure why I jumped in on this.
That's okay.
What were we talking about?
It was a good jump in because I'm conflating two different things. And so one thing I would say is that AT&T as being subject, AT&T is being subject to competitive pressures first, kind of foreshadows what might be happening in the Bell companies. So it informed us as to what to think about in terms of Bell companies, one. And then two, again, the frontier, where we were able to get to in terms of protecting jobs. Job security, I think, I don't know if it was unique for the telephone company. It was unique for that generation anyway.
Which one?
The generation that's working in the telephone company with 15-year service in the 80s and 90s, right?
They expected this to be lifetime employment.
Yeah, they expected it was going to be a lifetime employment, good job. There was this huge hiring bump in 68 after the Vietnam War, I mean, in terms of Vietnam vets who came back, which is like an interesting bump thing. But the frontier of that, as you said, was we were able to negotiate all kinds of notice and kind of amelioration programs, which are incredibly important in AT&T, become even more important in terms of 2 years. But I think a lot of those mimic in the Bell companies, because we had all those programs in the early 80s. They just weren't so substantial or so important or the focus of AT&T bargaining, I think, later on.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Jeff, did you want to jump in on that?
No, I mean, I don't want to go further down this rabbit hole with this because I really want to talk about jobs with justice in that era with George before we run out of time here.
Okay.
And I'm afraid if I say anything more, we'll just keep going down further.
Well, write a note so if we have more time, we can go down that. I do think it's important, though, to mention one thing, which is the pattern bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
AT&T would come first. Absolutely. It would be in May. The expiration would be in May, and then the Bell Company's expiration would be in August.
Mm-hmm.
And this was certainly true in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And
So there was a long history of pattern bargaining in telecom, which starts in the, you know, one company, one, it was one big company. The union and the company somehow would agree on we're going to bargain at Ohio Bell or wherever we're going to bargain at, and that's going to set a pattern for the rest of the country. So there was this notion of patterns within the company. And in America, there was, you know, big steel in the auto. Everybody, there was pattern bargaining that took place. Mm-hmm. And we must have thought the reason, I don't remember, there might have been a specific quid pro quo with an earlier agreement with AT&T, but we must have thought that we'll have more leverage with AT&T setting a pattern, since AT&T was a brighter star. We'll have more success setting a pattern with AT&T than kind of leaving it loose and picking one of the Bell companies. So there's a recognition that they were going to be different. And then the national focus, there would have been a residual feeling that, you know, AT&T is bigger, therefore we can focus on it, better to focus on one in the beginning and then let the others approach that pattern. But the other thing that had come up in terms of then the pattern, the 83 or 86, it had to be 86, the 86 bargaining is the first time the Bell companies have some flexibility or they're going to prove who they are. And it was the first time that we ran into lump sums, which reduced the ongoing base wage commitment. And this is, I remember in the old days, wall phone and a notebook by the wall phone, and Marty Hughes calling at, you know, 1 a.m. and saying, "This is good, George. I got him up to a 2% lump sum." "No, no, Marty Hughes, you want it to be the other way around." Conversation goes on, doesn't compute. But we anyway, lump sums get introduced into contracts at that point. And then it takes us a while to educate people about what's the difference between a lump sum and a base wage. How does that grow over time? I mean, people got it, but people didn't get it at the same time. And plus, you're solving a problem. You're making a deal with the company. The company wants to keep its wages down. You know, a big lump sum sounds like not a bad thing. It's money.
In one sentence, what's the problem with it?
In one sentence, the problem is over the long run, the lump sum is spent in the year that you get it, but you don't ever get it the second, third, fourth, or 20th year after that.
You don't compound as you go forward.
Right. No, you get the $1,000 this year, but you don't get $1,000 the next year, 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 the next year. Whereas if it's built into the wage, you're going to get it forever.
Okay.
And other industries were doing the same thing in terms of, auto at some point had, 10% lump sums. So we would be paying attention to what other industries were doing as well. So that's 86 lump sums. Healthcare becomes a big issue in that period. You have the famous 9X take a stand. We're not going to pay anything we're not going to pay premiums.
1989.
We're not going to pay premiums, which Morty writes as a misunderstanding between him and the CEO from the bargaining period before, where they wanted premiums in 86. And he said, you're not going to get premiums. And he ends up saying, we can discuss it again in 89. So in 89, we'll have the healthcare expire before the 89 bargaining. So we'll discuss it. In Morty's mind, that there's another bargaining thing. In the telephone exec's mind, it meant, okay, I got healthcare in 89. And that leads to a bitter strike in 89 over $1.17. So the premium charge was going to be $1.17.
You mean that the members would pay a small premium on their health insurance?
Yeah, we weren't going to pay a buck a month.
What was the slogan in 89?
Probably health care for all, not health cuts at 9X.
You got it.
Yeah. And we were able to align with other unions. Somehow the mine workers were fighting about health care. And we had a big march over Brooklyn Bridge led by a tank. So we had access to the National Guard facilities or something. Some tank comes rolling over the bridge with all of CWA marched behind it, marching on the telephone building.
In New York City?
In New York City, yeah, in 89. And then retiree health care became a thing then as well. And retiree health care was a problem because the Accounting Standards Board determined that the real financial health of a company is reflected in its future commitments on health care. And when you add up what the future commitments on health care for retirees is, it ended up being billions of dollars. And so at one level, okay, so we, the telephone industry, never had trouble paying its workers retiree health care on a cash basis year after year. My argument would be, well, so what? It's just a paper change. Who cares? Right? So write down $10 billion someplace. Everybody knows you owe it. And, we'll go on business as usual. But that was not – they used it as this massive cudgel to attack retiree health care. And then later on we learned, I don't know why we didn't know it, because we asked, but we never knew it. They made assumptions, the companies did, that they would get 15% or 20% cost sharing on retiree health. So when they filled out their financial things, they worked into their financials. We're going to get, in the future, we're going to get, the telephone workers will pay 30% of the cost of retiree health care. So that meant when we didn't pay 30%, it was a big deal for the companies, and they would take a charge of $1 billion to offset that loss. And then they got really serious about it when, if you do it once, that's okay. If you do it twice, that may be okay. But at some point, it's clear that the promise you have made to shareholders and in your financial statements that you will have a 70-30 cost sharing, company paying 70, you paying 30, is not true. And you're really just lying to shareholders about it. And therefore, you have to take the booking of the whole loss. And so it gradually became more and more serious. And the last place that this is jumping way ahead, I think right before I left, Are we on strike? And I remember, we must be on strike at, again, Verizon, and we're in the Secretary of Labor's office, and there's the CEO, new CEO, whose name I've just blocked on.
Adams? McAdams something?
But McAdams, I think, right.
But he's you're talking 2016 then.
Yeah, 26, the guy before the Dutch guy. Anyway, yeah, it's McAdams. Is because it's the Secretary of Labor's office, he's brought into the negotiations directly. And we're talking about the retiree health care. And McAdams is saying that he's, you know, he has a problem. You know, he has this problem of he doesn't want to recognize $2 billion worth of costs. This is not, if you did healthcare, $35,000, it's not a $10 million problem. It's not. It's a multi-billion dollar problem for him. So we get to a point where he says something to the effect of, you know, my problem is not the level of what we're paying for healthcare. My problem is that we keep raising it. And therefore, my shareholders don't have, and my accountants say to me, you don't have any level. It's a forever commitment. So we propose back then, okay, is that really the problem? Conversation, yes, it really is the problem. Well, in that case, then, let's take whatever the top, we're paying probably $36,000 a year for single, family coverage, single, anyway, $36,000 a year is the number that sticks in my head for coverage. We'll add a little bit to it to cover this current contract, and then we'll cap it there. And costs above this $40,000 a year for health care for retirees will be the cap. And you, the company, will agree to that, which is was there were programs that cost, say, $36,000. There are programs that cost $29,000, depending upon which of the options people picked. And in telephone world, everybody liked the Blue Cross Blue Shield Unlimited plan, but the reality was more and more the younger people were going into PPOs and all kinds of things which cost less, so that there was a dying population at this $40,000 figure. So we said, we'll cap it there. You'll always offer a plan that has no premium to people, and every X number of years that we need to, we'll meet and design a plan that has no premium, which meant the co-pays are this way or that. Something else might, because healthcare costs are balloon. You squeeze one end,
okay,
the costs pop out someplace else. We'll design something that has no premium. And those people who want to keep this plan that now costs $45,000 a year, they want to keep it, that's fine. They'll pay the premium on top of the 45 grand that the company is contributing to the their medical costs.
And this is about retiree health.
This is about retiree health. Yeah.
There it. Well,
and then it goes on from there in terms of saving money on the funding for it, which is a which was a mechanism to create a fund to fund it, which then kind of diminishes. So that over time, by 2016, we'd effectively not really had retiree health in the companies. We have some support, but not really.
That's a huge topic. So yeah, let's footnote
sorry.
That.
Yeah.
Jeff was very eager to hear about
jobs
origins. You want him to start at the beginning, talk about the origins of Jobs with Justice?
Yeah, I think so. I'd like to hear George's take on the whole thing. I mean,
okay.
I could do this with George for hours. This is great. So
well, we should,
wherever
we should,
he wants to take us is going to be fine with
well,
me.
I'm happy to do it again. I realized I went into the office to read some of the, particularly this period, 90s to read some of the bargaining stuff. No, and then 96 to 2000. See, I don't even remember. I took lots of notes. I realized I should have read also 2000 to 2015, because like, what the fuck did I do between, I was talking to Patrick on the way over here, and I said,
Patrick Hunt.
I didn't read anything between 2000 to 2015. I don't remember what the fuck happened during that period. And he says, well, that just confirms what I always knew. Top management never did anything anyway. I'm sorry, Jobs with Justice. So I'm in the research department. Boy, there's a story.
You can tell it.
I can tell. We'll put a bracket around it to see whether it gets edited out. So the story would be, I'm in the research department. My boss, Ronnie Straw, doesn't like me. He's chasing me out. And he's chasing me out in an aggressive way. Well, I'll go back. Well, this time's, anyway, it does tie back. It was really funny for me. This is back on the question of lump sums. This is a worthwhile story. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No.
We're getting to jobs with justice. We'll get there. So this is on lump sums. So when we have our first set of contracts with lump sums, we don't know how to report it out. So we're reporting out we won 10% wage increases because we're taking the 4% lump sum and we're adding it to the 2% base wage increases we got after that. And I said, you can't do that. That's wrong. And not understanding what I was saying even, but this just was wrong. I mean, I'm naive. So Johnny Carroll, who was the executive vice president, was in charge of bell bargaining. Ronnie Straw, the research department, reported to Johnny Carroll. Takes me to lunch, which has never happened to this kid, at one of these restaurants. And he says, Johnny Carroll, is saying to me, just tell me what you're saying. I don't really understand what you're saying. So we spend lunch, me explaining to him, trying to draw pictures, trying to figure out different ways to say it. It was hard to say in one sentence. It was a new idea, and I would get tongue-tied and way too complicated in details. But from Johnny Carroll's perspective, which I only realized many years later, I mean, his problem is he's gone out and he's told people, we've gotten 13% wage increases, we've gotten 10% wage increases, and you have the schmuck who works for him saying, that's not right. You're wrong about that. And Ronnie Straw, I don't think understood it either, but I don't know, or maybe Ronnie Straw just knew that he was stuck saying it. I'm not sure. At the time, I didn't think he knew what he was saying. Anyway, so that would be 83. That's kind of might have been perceived by him as my arrogance, and this is why he needed to get rid of me. But who knows? He was an alcoholic as well. Anyway, so I'm working in research department. That's 83. Ronnie's trying to push me out. I start applying for different jobs. I get offered a job at the Steelworkers. Lynn Williams is an incredibly smart, personable person. I mean, as Glenn would have been and as Morty would have been, but it's like I'm in awe of these people.
President of the
President of
Steelworkers.
the Steelworkers. I'm actually in awe of. There was a point as well where in New Jersey, Cohen wanted me to come up there and be a rep in New Jersey, and I didn't really want to, and it was a good thing that I didn't. But meeting Morty Barr at the time, again, I'm a little kid. He's a big union leader from New York. That's a big deal. Forgot where I was going.
I think it's how you got
Oh,
working
of
for
course.
Jobs with
So,
Justice,
yeah.
special projects
Okay,
person.
wait, I'm gonna go one more. Yeah. So anyway, so I'm working in the research department. Ryan Strong's trying to get fire me. I mean, Cohen thinks this is a bad thing, and probably says something to Barr. Dina Beaumont was an assistant then, as was Ted Watkins.
And Barr is now president.
Barr is now president. Yeah. So this is happy 85, 86. So they concoct a scheme without really telling me anything about it. Let me just think through what happens. The sequence of events would be, I'm working in a research department, I'm having these conflicts, they're trying to resolve these conflicts. Ted Watkins calls me up to his office, which is again the big deal for an underling, and says, George, I understand you're going to, that you're having some personnel issues. We're trying to work this out so you can come work for the president's office. And he describes a job. You'll come work for the president's office. We'll put you in a little cubicle. You'll have this. He's telling me this job in a way that later on I understand he wants to be able to describe it this way to Ronnie Straw, that they're not doing something good for me. They're doing something not so good for me. So I hear all
And
the.
Ted Watkins' position is.
He's the assistant to the president. He came with Morty from New York, and he was Morty's hatchet man. So he was the one who delivered good news and bad news. When Ted wanted to see you, it was serious, whatever it was. So I think about that as I'm walking out. And I said, that doesn't sound so great. And I run into Dina, Beaumont in the hallway.
She at that point is?
Was Morty's other assistant. And she throws her arm around me and says, George, it's so great that you're going to be working with us. And I shake my head and think, I don't know, Dina. Ted described it to me. It didn't sound so good. So I go back down to my office. She calls me, half hour later. Says, George, come up here and talk to me. And I said, this is how you could tell I had one foot out the door, right? I say to her, well, Dina, I'm busy right now. I'll come see you later when I'm done with what I'm doing. Which, again, I never would have done as a kid in a big bureaucracy. So I go back up, and she paints a whole different picture about how wonderful this is, and this is the way that they're taking me out from underneath Ronnie Straw, and this is the way in which Ted needed to describe it because he's talking, he wanted, not to insult Ronnie Straw too much. Anyway, so I became a research assistant in the president's office. We go through an 86. This is a time when Lotus is just developed as well. This is the other thing I was saying about all the technology we've been through.
Lotus, you mean Excel?
Lotus.
The version of Excel?
No, I mean Lotus, the program that was a key protist. Lotus 1-2-3 version.
Spreadsheet.
The spreadsheet program, Lotus 1-2-3, which allowed you to sort things in version 2, not version 3 even. So I'm able to, we're on strike someplace, and I'm able to actually take the spreadsheet and sort it different ways, and this is how we could have a support program for the different locals. We didn't talk about United, that comes later anyway. So, blah. So I'm in the president's office doing special projects. I am an important research assistant. I'm a research assistant in the president's office, and it goes on for a couple of years, and they promote me to director of special projects. Can't even be a couple of years. It has to be a year. They promote me to director of special projects, which is a great title because there's no responsibility and total freedom to run. And what happens then in the winter of 86 is we're organizing MCI facilities in Detroit. And they shut them down in a particularly brutal way, which if you got the story from Larry, you probably got the story. Christmas hotel rooms, escort back up to clean out your desk one by one. Meeting with Conyers. Conyers says,
John Conyers,
a congressman from Detroit. We need jobs. Larry says back, no, we need jobs with justice. And at that same time, SEIU lost the building contract for downtown Detroit. The auto workers had the first of their, I don't know if the first, but the first of a series of big plant shutdowns or maybe massive shutdowns. And so we, I guess the we would have been Larry and I, or I'm not sure who the we was, but anyway, Larry and I are, there's a coalition here to be formed. And how are we going to follow up this Conyers meeting where, we need jobs. No, we need jobs with justice. So we developed, and it was my contacts amongst other weird people in unions or people in different unions that we were able to bring together 10 unions who were going to be on this page of we need to fight back against plant closings. Because we had 1980, we got Reagan with the Patco destruction. We have international paper where Al Dunlop is just chopping the shit out of the paper workers. You get the permanent. No, he did something else. Paper workers fight was permanent replacements. For the first time, paper workers go on strike and they're permanently replaced, which is just mind-boggling change in terms of what the expectation is about strikes. Then you have later on Chainsaw Al. But you got Frank Lorenzo, who's a robber baron operating in the airlines industry, and clearly a bad actor that's just almost known at the time. So we're putting together then a coalition to fight back in the early part of 87. And so we conceptualize it as it'd be a series of rallies and demands about jobs with justice, because this is what we need.
And just jobs with justice means union jobs? Is that what the justice is?
It was more ephemeral than that, because what we wrote in the early part of that year, we would have wrote a pledge card. So that the issues would have been, employment security, which reflects the auto workers' plant shutdown, as well as our own kind of stuff. Healthcare for all, which would have reflected our stuff and everybody's stuff. Right to organize. And another one, we'll have to look it up on the internet. On the right to organize, which reflected our MCI stuff. And decent wages, and decent standard of living. So those were the four elements. So these are the four things that we're for and that we need in the American economy. And if we sign this pledge card and we promise to be there for my fight as well as five other fights during the course of the year, we can turn this around and we can win, start winning again. So that was the pledge card. So I had the pledge card for individual commitment, and then institutionally it was conceptualized, we're going to have a series of rallies to put this on the map as a real demand leading into the 88 presidential campaigns. And we're going to kick it off in Detroit in the spring with the auto workers around May Day Labor Day. Let me just think this one through. And we're going to kick it off with the auto. When was our convention?
Was Miami.
It was Miami, but what month was it? It was in the summer. Because we would have been cheap. Hotels would have been cheap in Miami. So it would have
usually
been
July in Miami.
Yeah, so I think it's in July. Yeah. So anyway.
Sweltering.
There was three. There's this vision of we're going to put this on the map of media and a real political demand and labor movement. We're going to have the auto workers with a massive march in Detroit. We'll have something else. I can't remember what it was. And then we'll have the CWA convention in Miami, where we already have a captive audience of 3,000 people. We'll invite Miami. And in Miami at the time, Andy Banks, who was with Florida International University, was working with the Machinist Union, a guy named Charlie Bryant, the Lodge, which was Eastern Airlines, Mary Jane Berry, who would have been the independent flight attendant's head. And he was tied into the local milieu of labor as well. So the auto workers couldn't pull the trigger on their massive march. And it was my heartbreak of the auto workers occurred in 87. I can't remember who the second one was, but that didn't fruit as well. So that left it then to kick off to be the CWA convention. So the CWA convention in that year, Lorenzo was taking out Eastern Airlines in a vicious way.
The CEO.
The CEO, the first of many of robber barons. And they were fighting back, and it was an active fight back campaign. Because that was the thing in the 80s, was it just do you just give concessions or do you fight back? And we were trying to create a mood where, no, you got to fight back. So we're going to kick off Jobs with Justice, has put it on the map at the CWA convention. So we rent the hall next door to the CWA convention. Lots of logistics about how are we going to make sure the CWA people go to the rally, they don't go to the bar. How do you open the doors? How do you get people in there? All that works out. Actually, Cohen is going nuts because, you know, no one's going to come. If you can imagine John Ryan and Seth Rosen and a third person say, well, we'll help phone bank the flight attendants list because we're relying on Annie Banks and the independent flight attendant union to bring their people, the machinists to bring their people. That we're being told, no problem, no problem, no problem. Well, anyway, it turned out they were correct. There was no problem. 12,000-15,000 people show up. And in constructing the first one, we had a thing where we wanted people to speak to. It wasn't going to be a typical rally with, you know, every major leader speaking. And so it was interesting for me to tell Barr, we're going to have 10,000 people in this auditorium, and you're going to sit in the audience and just hear the stories of individuals, much less other people. I mean, he was fine. He'd been speaking all day, but he would have been happy to speak. And then the other thing that...
Who spoke for CWA?
It was a worker who had lost... I don't know who spoke for CWA. I don't remember. I don't know that we had a CWA speaker.
Didn't we have one of those Detroit workers?
Did we?
I think so.
Did we? Okay. Yeah, I just don't remember. Yeah. That would have made sense. It would have made sense that we would have had a Detroit worker, there would have been a jobs person and a healthcare person. We would have had a person who symbolized each of the different issues and then each of the different industries, which would have been airlines and us and manufacturing.
And how much of this was Larry Cohn?
How much?
Envisioning this and structuring it.
Maybe we say it's all Larry, but I don't really know how much was Larry. I mean, I was left to do all the work. And so if you imagine, you know, Larry has a vision, we're going to do this. And Morty is incredible in this period because Morty, this is risky. It's outside the comfort zone. It's risky. And he's fully in. Larry's the assistant. He's fully in. So that the political support for whatever stupid mistakes I would have made or stupid things I did was, you know, 100% assured. Plus, I'm naive enough to not even understand that, you know, shit like that can happen to anybody.
And is part of the risk that the AFL-CIO is opposing this?
That comes later. So okay. The risk is definitely that the AFL-CIO is not doing anything, that it's moribund, and this is things that they should be doing. We've been arguing that they should be doing things like this for years, and they're not doing it. So the other thing that we did to make it different than the AFL-CIO is we said it's a citizen labor coalition. So Citizen Action was a key founder of Jobs with Justice, and that was, it's different than just a labor rump group or a labor faction. It's a different kind of coalition.
Was there a people of color, is the right word now?
No.
Organization? It was Citizen Action and
Citizen
labor.
Action, I mean, yes. I mean, that's a true statement. I'm just trying to think. I don't think people of color was a big deal in 1987, to be blunt. There was clue. There's a coalition of black trade unionists. There was African American sentiment, but it was not. It was not a political force. And then for CWA, I mean, it was a point where women was a political force. So you could talk about what was happening to women. And that was new and different. So we engaged now. Now is another key element of that coalition because now cared about women or the whoever led now at that point.
Ellie Smeal, probably.
Probably Ellie Smeal understood that women's wages and unions were linked. So she was part of it. I mean, there must have been an African-American thing, but I don't remember them being relevant. I know that in Miami, Johnson from the Bus Workers Union was critical, and he was tied into the NAACP. So there might have been lower levels of people. And then across my period. So Cohen, I must have had to tell somebody that we're going to have just people sit in the audience. And Cohen would have supported that decision. I can't imagine I didn't tell him. But so he supported that decision. And then we made a decision, we're going to invite all the presidential candidates because this was how we're going to make it a political move, but we're also not going to let any of them speak. We're going to put them in the audience as well. And that was particularly important because we kind of recognized Jesse Jackson was running for president. He'd be the only one who would show up. And for the Miami labor community, which had big Cuban elements to it that were progressive, minus the Cuba situation, Jesse Jackson was despised. So we didn't want to fracture the nation coalition with Jesse Jackson coming. Okay. So we sent out the letters to all the presidential candidates. The other backstory would be Barbara Shaler, who's at the Machinists, is my running partner in this. And so she's also deeply committed to the Jackson campaign.
And the Machinists are the ones that are fighting Eastern Airlines, right?
They're the AFL union is fighting Eastern Airlines. The independent flight attendants are also fighting Eastern Airlines and are equally important but kind of marginalized with labor. Yes. And it was then within the machinist structure, it was their lodge. So like a CWA sector, they had Lodge 100, which would have been the mechanics who dealt with, I don't even know if they had the ground support system. Anyway, the mechanics who dealt with Eastern Airlines. Okay. So we get to the big day. I'm laughing because Annie Banks says, oh, we got to film this. We got to do it on 16 millimeter film because it'll be so much more dramatic. Anyway, and then that film just disappears. And the other funny story would be I had roped in the Act Two. So there's a series of progressive unions that you could count on. Act Two was one of them. Act Two donated. Bill Patterson was working there. Bill, what can you do to help us build this thing? Well, I can get you some T-shirts. So he got us 10,000 T-shirts. Andy Banks says, well, I can get them printed down here in the South cheaper. Fine, Bill, send them to Andy. Andy prints out 10,000 T-shirts. He puts a fucking palm tree on every one of them. Whereas I had intended these shirts to be Jobs with Justice to be used any place. Oh, this is funny, too. We're talking about a banner. We need a Jobs with Justice banner. Francine Zuchter, who is CWA's PR director, says, yeah, you need one. It'll cost you $3,000 to make it. Annie Banks says, I got a retired sign painter, who can do it. And you know, we don't need it on silk. It can be on brown paper, basically. And it'll look just as fine. And indeed, he was right. That cost us a couple hundred bucks.
What other unions were
in there? So CWA would have been there. So it would have been IUE, Act Two, AFSCME. So Lee Saunders, who becomes the president of AFSCME at the time, is working in the AFSCME research department. And I know Lee from that. SEIU was not. No, Mary Jane Collins. Yeah, SEIU was involved. The teachers, I don't think, were really involved.
ILG.
ILG. James Parrott would have been involved. Auto workers, nominally, but disappointingly.
Steel workers. Or mine workers, no.
Mine workers were big. Yeah, Ken Zinn at the mine workers was big. Steel.
So all these names you've mentioned are kind of your generation of staffers.
Right. Right.
And it was their job to get the
president to sign off. Right. And then they could
use. So it wasn't Morty to the presidents of those unions?
No. And so it was helpful to them to say, because Morty was so respected, that they could say to whatever other union president they're talking to, hey, this is Morty Barr's thing. So different unions had different things that they did. Morty supports us on this. This is Morty's thing. You should sign on to this. This is a okay thing. There's nothing. And the other unions would have known that the guardrail was Morty Barr, and that was an acceptable guardrail for them because Morty Barr was so well respected inside the labor movement. So then it was staff that ran around to get other unions involved. And it was partly, Cohen would say, you know, we need this to be a volunteer effort with unions reallocating part of their resources to make Jobs with Justice work. We do not want an external staff run external organization. This is going to be an internal, quote unquote, volunteer efforts by staff, by unions committing staff to make this thing work.
So finish with, I know these are wonderful stories about the convention.
Yeah.
Finish anything you want to add, and then I want to hear more about how
what happened afterwards.
You built Jobs with Justice. But one of the things that's interesting to me, listening to you, as I would ask you the name of a union, and you would say a staffer of your generation, that in itself is a very interesting phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these were not people who came out of the ranks of the unions, correct? Mm-hmm. And so it's a kind of activism of transforming the union movement.
In some ways, yeah. I mean, so
how would you respond to my comment?
So responding to your comment would be, we would have seen, or I would have seen, the AFL-CIO and its bureaucracy captured by these conservative social Democrats who have a name that I don't remember what it is. So
you the Shackmanites.
Whatever they are. But they cared about foreign policy, and they cared about foreign policy, the Cold War. That was their deal. And the labor movement was going to be on the right side of the foreign policy questions. And screw any engagement with anybody else if that engagement could be construed as communist influence, because the key thing that they were fighting against was communists. So I'm jumping ahead at this point because I do want to go back. But anyway, but jumping ahead. No, let me go. No, yeah, never mind. I'll jump ahead. So that Tom Donahue was Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO and Morty's good friend, came over to see Morty to tell him 2 years later, as Jobs with Justice is spreading across the country, Morty, this is terrible. Look what the communists are saying about this. And he brings him a file folder of People's Daily's papers where, you know, we say we're going to have a march in 16 cities. Their front page would be a map of the U.S. with stars in 16 cities. We say we're going to do fight against Blue Cross Blue Shield in these 10 cities. Front page story. And so Donahue's bringing this stuff to Morty saying, you know, this is terrible, Morty. You know, you're going to be commies. And Morty was definitely not a commie and didn't like commies. Anyway, but he sent me the file folder with a kind of a FYI. And that's kind of like Donahue's attempt to squish it on those kinds of grounds. So it didn't. So I think that was another boundary we were dealing with, was the end of the Cold War era. We needed to have a different major contradiction that we were going to be fighting against, as opposed to the communist influence.
End part one. Begin part two.
I forgot to introduce this. this is an interview with George Cole. We're now 2 hours into it.
You can edit it at the beginning if you like.
Okay. And it is January, what did we say? January 8th, 2024. We're in Washington, D.C. Jeff Reckenbach is on Zoom in Cleveland, Ohio.
So I made the joke about Andy and Bill. And then and we're talking about the rally. Anyway, so then we have 10,000 people there. And we have these very powerful local speakers, as well as ours, talking about the different issues, with brings tears to people's eyes. So Morty's in the audience, and the people, anyway, Morty's in the audience listening, and is being moved by these talks. And Andy was very important, a guy named Frank Jackalong, who worked for the Citizen Action Affiliate, Florida Consumer Federation, in terms of prepping these people and getting them comfortable with their statements.
What's his name?
Frank Jackalone.
Do you know how to spell that?
I just phonetically.
J-A.
J-A-C-K-A-L-O-N-E. That's how I spell it.
Okay.
I have no idea how he spells it. Did a great job preparing these people to make their statements. They were just mind-boggling. We were keeping everybody very short. The thing was moving along. But at the very beginning, in a nod to something, protocol, we had the mayor welcome us to Miami. And he's going on and on and on. And I guess I am in charge, but I always had some problems accepting that notion. So Andy Banks is going nuts. Like, he's going on too long. You got to do something about it. So they shoved me up on the stage to do something about it. So I walk up to the mayor and thank him very much. He's in the middle of his thing, something about soaring like an eagle. And so I chime in right behind him. Yes, soaring like an eagle is exactly what we're going to do. Thank you, blah, 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 blah. Welcome, Mayor so-and-so. So the next kind of programmatic crisis is Jesse Jackson does show up for the rally. And people, meaning Andy Banks in this point, is just hysterical that Jackson's got 12,000 people in the audience. How's he not going to speak to them? So we knew that he was coming. So I had the stage set up so that these massive speakers were set right by the stairs, one. And then two, we offered Jackson a room right next off of our room to do a press conference. So he could do his press conference right after our thing. He's there. Barbara Shaler wants him to speak to these 10,000 people. They're her members. It's like his crowd. This is what should happen. So she pushes him forward, and he walks across on his tiptoes across the stage in front of the speakers and sits down in the chair right next to where the speakers are going to be speaking, and like it's all ready to go. Banks goes crazy. You got to do something, George. I'm thinking to myself, yeah, I got to do something. So I walk over to Jackson, and I whisper in his ear, Mr. Jackson, security is very concerned about you here. See that seat right next to Jan Pierce? That's what we are saving for you, and that's safe. He hopped up out of his chair and went right down and sat next to Jan, and it was like crisis averted. So that was how that crisis was averted. Later on, Barbara, who was pretty pissed, but we were friends, sends a very funny thing about the incident. Anyway, she died of lung cancer. Blah, 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 blah. So it's a huge success, this rally. The emotions within CWA are kind of powerful. The speeches are powerful. People are moved by it. It's I don't know if this is the first, but it's the first in a long time of kind of individuals telling their stories in a profound way and it making the political point. And it's kind of like a trend. So then the next question is, how are we going to follow this up? And again, the goal had been to make Jobs with Justice be the pivotal point in the 88 presidential race, one. And then two, the energy that it released, particularly across the South, was pretty substantial. So that this thing had kind of two rules. One was, at the top, labor unions, at least the nine progressive unions that were signed on to it, the presidents were for it. So it was not an outsider thing. So a local could get involved in it, and it was sanctioned. That was one. And then two, it was, we're not going to tell you what to do. A, we don't have any staff or money. And so there's local freedom and local autonomy to do whatever you want, whatever your fight is, take it on, just put it under the banner of Jobs with Justice. And by taking your local fight, making it part of the Jobs with Justice, we will create this movement for Jobs with Justice. And it was those two elements, I think, that allowed it to grow and multiply across the South. And then different unions picked it up to do different things. The mine workers had a bunch of issues. I don't remember. I mean, Pittston, I don't remember, comes after that, I think. And they didn't make Pittston a Jobs with Justice fight, but it was in the spirit thereof. Their guy in the South was an African-American guy, whose name I'm blocking on, from Birmingham, was big in it as well. But again, across the South, where there weren't strong labor councils, there was no real opposition to it. In the North and in some parts of the Midwest, depending on who labor was, there was enormous opposition to it, and they wanted to squish it. Or there was a grudging acceptance to it because some big enough affiliates were part of it that it was okay, and it had a citizen element to it, therefore it wasn't a duplication of what the Central Labor Council was. It really was a duplication of what several Central Labor Councils should have done, sans this. And then people like in Cleveland, I mean, John becomes CLC president.
John Ryan.
John Ryan becomes CLC president, kind of on a Jobs with Justice-like program. In Missouri, there was a guy, Duke McVeigh, who was head of the state Fed, who was for it. And so in Missouri, Jobs with Justice ends up being, later on, an important political arm of the AFL-CIO because he saw it as the potential instead of a threat. In New York, forget about it. It was marginal, and it did have some role later on, but generally it was marginal. So the more established and more effective a labor movement was, or the more bureaucratic and more ossified a Central Labor Council was, the more they saw Jobs with Justice as a threat to their existence and would try and smash it out.
Within CWA, were the organizers part of the driving force?
Mm-hmm. Well, within CWA, it was whatever network we could work. So that was then the second point. I don't know, second point. That was an important point, is that within unions, the organizing directors, within CIO unions in particular, the organizing directors were very important, resource-heavy people. So having the organizing directors be supportive of Jobs with Justice, meaning Cullen being supportive of it, meaning Mark Fleischman at Actium, anyway, whoever the names were, Andy Stern at SDIU being supportive of it.
Paul Booth.
Paul Booth being supportive of it. And asked me. In fact, Paul tells his own origin story of Jobs with Justice, and his story is nothing like mine. I mean, his is a Paul Booth story, which I wish I could have written down before I... That's why I knew Jobs with Justice was a success, when everybody was claiming credit for its creation. But the organizing directors were very important because they control significant resources within unions, and it enabled them.
So what were... And Jeff, join in on this. Maybe in Cleveland is a good case study for it. What were some of the achievements, innovative things that Jobs with Justice did?
So I have not a clue. I don't remember in that it was local. I will say the two that did pop up that I know something about. One would be at this point, Morty and Wimpensinger.
From
the Machinists are the two international presidents committed to this. In part, Wimpy's committed because it's about Eastern Airlines. And Morty at one point jokingly complains that it must be Saturday because he's with Wimpy again at some rally someplace. So Morty and Wimpy were rallying the troops all along about why we need to fight with Jobs with Justice and proselytizing for it. So not only was he like benignly for it, it was like central to some of Morty's own work and certainly some of his own time, because we did a big rally in Iowa, the state fed, which was progressive. A guy named Mark Smith was secretary treasurer. He did a rally, 2,000-3,000 people in Iowa. Morty and Wimpy are there speaking, and it's again trying to put Jobs with Justice on the map as a key political issue. I say we failed at that, but we did what we could do. The other big thing, big success story, which I know of only because it's CWA, is in Texas, in Nacogdoches, Texas. We replicated kind of where Danny Fatanti and Sandy Rusher were. We replicated who were the organizing directors of the district. We had organized a place, Stephen F. Austin College in Eastern Texas, which is the Confederate part of Texas. And so black cafeteria workers were there, and even walking into the white administration building was a big deal for them. They were bargaining a contract, and we mobilized 3,000 people to go to Stephen F. Austin, to Nacogdoches, Texas, and do a march there. And so Nacogdoches hadn't seen anything like that. And that would be definitely a civil rights / economic / union march. And that was a big, big deal. And even the conservative people in the union, who wouldn't have necessarily liked it, and this guy would be a guy named Albert Bowles, who would have been opposed to organizing. Albert had connections to the rail unions. He got the rail unions to cut the train off so that the train wouldn't disrupt the march, so that everybody was engaged in a way which was wonderful, which was wonderful. So I got to ride the wave of being connected to, if only vicariously, all these wonderful people in the labor movement who could make things happen, who did make things happen. And kind of my role in some ways was ending up, mediating this. We have this, we're not going to interfere. So there'd be certain unions or certain presidents or their staff would say, well, we can't do this in North Carolina, wherever it was, we can't do this. It's blah, 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 blah. And we'd be, no, that's not our role is, this local autonomy. Locals can do what they want to do. So providing locals with autonomy was like a key buffer role that I played in making this happen. And then we started trying to do annual meetings. And the first annual meeting is, 20 people. And we work out, and then the next one's 30, and the next one's 100. It starts to grow and gets too big. So the format for these meetings was also then tricky in terms of what are you trying to do. But in my mind, one of the last best ones would have been in Denver relatively small so that you could have one open circle. I mean, once you got beyond one open circle, the dynamics of the meeting changed. Or once the open circle got too big, it was hard to do. Or once it had happened too many times so that some of the key people who were pushing it within their unions had other demands on their time, it would fade away. Support would fade away. But the last one that was significantly successful was in Denver. We were fighting with the healthcare costs, fighting with Blue Cross Blue Shield. The slogan was cut the red tape. The people who were there were all leaders in their local communities or national support people who could make things happen in their unions. And we did an action at the Blue Cross Blue Shield headquarters in Denver, where we wrapped the building in red tape, which is another whole story about the red tape, which I'll have to remember someday. But we got this beautiful 6-inch red tape. Hold the bait. You know, 1 inch is so much cheaper. Is that better? Nah, 6 inches. You need a big piece of red tape to wrap the building. It's got to be visible. But we did that action and wrapped the building in red tape. And then everybody went home and did a whole bunch of them as well. I was going to say 40. We also had a hepatitis scare, which is another story. But that would have been a success. But then it had gotten big enough that we broke the rule of that Georgia Special Projects is going to be donated to run this thing. And we hired staff. And hiring staff began the kind of erosion. I'm trying to think if you have a mineral and you have water around it and it soaks the minerals away. Leaching's too strong. Anyway, began to suck away a little bit of the institutional support and commitment that people can say, oh yeah, I'm for Jobs with Justice, as opposed to having to spend time doing it, because we have staff now that's spending time to do it. And so it became less core to what the work was, because it was farmed out. It was to somebody else to do that work. But it still continued to grow. And then the staff and the organizers, the first one was Bob Nicholas, who was not particularly great, but he was fine. He ended up at AFSCME. And there was Karen Zelenko, who was also not particularly great, but fine, and ended up at the Teamsters and then the AFL-CIO. And then there was Fred Ascarati, who came out of the USSA and Citizen Action. United States Students Association and Citizen Action. And he was terrific. And then following him. And then at that point, we...
Wait. Following him was...
Sarita Gupta. But I was going
to
say...
You've skipped somebody who went to the Department of Labor. Woman. Maybe she wasn't director. Maybe she was number two with Fred.
Could have been.
You know who I'm talking about.
I'm sure I do, but I don't remember. Next one is Sarita Gupta, who came out of Chicago. And by this point, in certain areas, well, actually, the SEIU had taken over the Central Labor Council in Chicago. Tom Balanoff, from the famous Balanoff Steel family, was their head. He was involved early on. Was supportive of it, so that you had certain Central Labor Councils becoming important, being able to use it. And Sarita came out of Chicago, and she was the next director.
Mary Beth Maxwell is who I was thinking of.
Right. So Mary Beth.
She was
Beth,
probably number two with Fred.
She was number two with
Fred.
They
were partners.
Yeah. Then Sarita. Then we get into the big fight for EFCA, which I can't remember what
year. Employee Free Choice Act.
The Employee Free Choice Act. We never say EFCA. We always say the Employee Free Choice Act. I can't remember what years those were at. Cullen's president by now, so that's in 95. To 2000, is it after 2000?
Obama period, I
yeah,
believe.
Yeah, but I don't, when was he president?
2008.
2008. So this all the way jumped to 2008. And we, meaning Cohen, sets up a American Rights at Work, which is going to provide the framework for the Employee Free Choice Act. And then later on, my argument, which I lost, was that that should be part of Jobs with Justice. It was set up separate. Then later on, they merge and changes the character of Jobs with Justice. What was the other argument? The other thing that's true is that recognizing that organizing directors were important, Jobs with Justice was a place for them to get together. And so the unions that formed Change to Win were all together forming Jobs with Justice. And then what was ironic and interesting is that when Sweeney is elected president or changed to win, takes over the AFL-CIO, Morty was a Tom Donohue guy. So Morty, who was core to Jobs with Justice, was not part of the cabal that became the AFL-CIO. And then maybe that was, and so the organizing, other organizing directors of the unions then were more focused on doing program there and competing, our words, with Jobs with Justice. But, you know, they had the resources there, and that was their platform.
And then you had the Union Cities program under Sweeney, which I think was trying to use the Central Labor Councils to become like
Jobs with Justice. Exactly. Exactly.
But I was going to ask, Jeff, in Cleveland, you had a very active Jobs with Justice. Did you want to talk about that? And also the Workers' Rights Board.
It's much later. Yeah.
It does relate back to, you know, having one person as a driving force. So John Ryan takes over the Central Labor Council. Jobs with Justice, in effect, becomes an arm of the Central Labor Council, with John supervising the work and driving it. And so we had really a terrific coalition, religious groups. We had, you know, this a guy from the United Church of Christ, Bob Stroman, who was Reverend Bob Stroman, was fantastic. And we were able to do a lot of that work. When John left the AFL-CIO, it just collapsed. And we still have a woman here who runs it, but frankly, it's it isn't engaged at all in the labor movement anymore. It's kind of run off on its own path and doesn't really connect with labor in a meaningful way any longer, unfortunately.
And that's my actually experience with other Jobs with Justice. It's kind of, it took this turn into kind of identity, sexual and identity politics, and lost something. And that comes after the big fight for the Employee Free Choice Act and the changes of staffing at Jobs with Justice as well. But you're right about workers' rights boards. They were an element where, like, how do we hold up these cases of these incredible individuals who have risked a lot to organize or suffered? How do we hold them up? Well, you hold them up with a community labor forum that hears the case and then goes to the Bluebell Ice Creams, goes to the place that did the harm and tries to make it, put pressure on them to right the wrong.
Do you have a sum up then? Do you think it was the right vision of what was needed at that time? The tension between institutionalizing something or something as opposed to just coming out of volunteer energy and passion?
Well, those are different things. But anyway, what I was going to try and say was that it was the notion of a coalition of the willing, and identify a big enough coalition of the willing, who's willing to move forward along your path, was, I think, the critical thing. And then the critical thing was real institutional support, which meant some money and some staff time, and then a willingness to trust Barr that we're not going to interfere and tell locals what to do, but we're going to respect that result, which that was a little bit unique compared to the AFL-CIO in terms of, no, this is what we're going to do, and no, you are not going to be against the Vietnam War in Colorado. So I think that would be it. And then it really begged the fight back. It wasn't as a fight back movement. It was not quite big enough. I mean, it never is. And so I'm not sure the forces of the economy were so big that was sad. But we came very close to a bunch of things that whole era. We came close to a bunch of things in terms of change or the possibilities of change, but never quite made the changes that we would have liked. So unfortunately, I sum up my career as I helped the labor movement go from 17% to 6% of the private sector, and that's not exactly a ringing endorsement for anything I say. So,
I was getting to the kind of big picture questions, but before we do, I'm going to ask you something that I should have done at the very beginning. Mm. We got as far on your timeline of Jobs with Justice don't give detail underneath, but let's just flesh out the timeline.
Sure.
So then you became research director?
So I was director of special projects, right? Then I became research director, and then I became an assistant to the president.
And which presidents?
Barr. So Barr, Cohen, Shelton.
Okay.
So Ron Allen retires. See, this I wrote down. Ron Allen retires, and I replaced him.
Mm-hmm. So during your period as research director and assistant to president, what would you say were some of your greatest accomplishments?
That's a good question. I'd have to think more about that, but I think that I don't know. For me personally, which is not you, it was the growing ability to take pleasure in the fact that I hired Debbie Goldman, and she was just terrific in customer service and women's stuff, right? Or that Louise, I mean, when I first became research director, I knew more than everybody. And so it was a big transition for me personally to let go of things and to be able to be pleased, enjoyed, supportive of people who are doing great things.
You were mentioning another name. I wanted you to say that name.
So I think in the healthcare fight, I think Louise Novotny and I, but so me beginning, but then Louise Novotny took it miles beyond wherever I could go. We were important in the healthcare fights and important in the analysis of healthcare and importance of the recognition of the problem and then trying to figure out ways to go around the problem. And so we came up with, there's a woman, Kathy Shane, who worked at SEIU, who was a big time healthcare expert, who was our mentor. And she told us about this new thing, PPOs. And as a market force, if you can gather the customers, you can get a discounted deal with the other guy. So we were able to introduce that to AT&T, and AT&T actually accepted it, and it put off healthcare cost shifting a different way. We made big fights to try and break class solidarity amongst the employers by pointing out to AT&T, national healthcare, you would save $3 billion a year, and that $3 billion was not worth their while to sign on to a national healthcare or a Medicare for All bill. So we had it was stunning. I mean, you could conceive, but it was remarkable that they weren't interested in that. And then, so I think we play a big role in the healthcare fights. I think we played
both in bargaining and in policy.
Bargaining and policy. Yeah, but really, it was bargaining and policy in linking them, but it really ended up in minimizing the amount that we paid in bargaining. So for our members, it was the right linkage, but we never made the real thing we wanted to do, which is eliminate the issue from bargaining. But we were able to save members lots of money over 10 years because have Barr and 9X bit in 89 on the $1.17 and or $1.72 in premium, it would have just gone up from there. But the other reality is, that when you start thinking about, once you start healthcare cost shifting or healthcare payments by employees, the question of who do you want, who should suffer the consequences? Is it the sick person? Is it the whole unit? Premiums are actually not the worst way to go. But we had already created for ourselves this thing that premiums were off the table.
At one point, Morty had Dick Notabart, the head of Ameritech at the time, convinced to go along with this and flew into Milwaukee to make some big pronouncement with Clinton.
Right.
And then Notabart got some cold feet and sort of backpedaled a bit on it. I think he finally came out just he would support the employer mandate, but that was it.
So. Right, right. Exactly. He was.
But he got a lot of pressure from his telecom peers to back down.
Well, telecom peers and then other peers. I mean,
Right.
All the businesses that were customers, right? Yep. I'm your customer. You're going to screw me like this. Yeah, he was the exception at that point.
So mentoring, a crew developing a research department and mentoring.
Yeah, it was personally satisfying.
And would you say that as well with the organizers, the relationship?
The relationship was terrific on my end. So on my end, so you think from 1980, we're organizing as the butt end of the union. Junior guy gets the assignment. I think once I'm director, I create this dynamic. No, organizing is the most important thing we can do. And in fact, you know, any organizing request that comes in, it's going to be handled the next day or maybe within 3 days, but the next day. And then we were still doing files and paper back then. So every organizing request went into a red folder. And if a red folder shows up on your desk, it's going to be handled right away because organizing is the most important thing we're going to do. And it's often time sensitive. You know, time goes on, organizers can do a lot of that themselves. But back then, resources were on paper and consolidated. So I think creating a mindset that organizing was important or in my little area was important. And then within the union, that was a massive conversation that I say happened three times in the history of the union. So in 1980, Glenn Watts hires an organizing department, which is controversial, but we pushed through. In 85, the question is it going to be Barr or Bowie? And Barr is the organizing candidate, and Bowie is a more traditional candidate. Then Cohen gets elevated, and it's going to be Cohen or Pisha or Cohen. And yeah, that was that election was the key election. And then Cohen becomes president. But so those are three referendums of the union on the question of organizing. One by Fiat and the executive board not opposing Glenn Watts. The second one, the executive board voting to endorse Morty after Morty and Jim Bowie make a deal. And the third one, the convention, you know, by the skin of its 5,000 votes, by the skin of its teeth, voting for Cohen over Sue Pisha, were the three kind of referendums. What kind of union are we going to be? And a leadership, local leadership ratification of that. Period. Period.
What were the biggest? So do you want to add to achievements?
I'd have to look at a list, actually. If I could look at the list, I would say, oh, yeah, that was good that I did or I was involved with. So most of it I see as like being a useful, productive role within the organization, a place that where I could solve problems or things would come my way and I would figure out ways to make it, whatever the it, progressive or positive thing happen. So I don't think of it as big programmatic things. I think it was kind of incidental, greasing the skids kind of thing, be that as it may. So Cohen came up with whatever the growth funds and the SIF funds and
strategic industry funds.
Yeah, so I would administer that, and the organizers would have ideas about what they wanted to do with it. I would help them shape what the idea is and then process the paperwork and to make it happen. Or we're doing a mobilization thing. It's like I just blocked on Nick's last name. The assistant from District 3, who was a local guy, became the assistant for
Savant.
Noah Savant.
Nick.
Nick is, there's Richard Honeybee, Huckleby.
Richard Honeycutt?
Honeycutt. His assistant was Nick.
Still is.
I
predate the Honeycutt era.
You do? Oh, you do. Okay. All right. So Nick, whatever Nick is, Nick was terrific. I love Nick. But he didn't really, he came from a local, so he didn't really have a good sense of how does the levers of power and how do the levers of CRWA bureaucracy work. And so I could say to Nick, this is how it works. And so you want to do this, you should do that. You want to accomplish this goal, do that. So I could help lots of people accomplish their mobilization and political goals or funding goals or, you know, resource flowing goals towards those programs.
And what were the biggest, this is a big period, but what were some of the biggest challenges that maybe you weren't able, or the union wasn't able to sufficiently overcome?
Oh, you know what? I thought of another thing that I was involved with, which was the whole filibuster fight.
This was during Obama period.
So the filibuster fight. So this is Cohen's insight, is that we can't achieve. I don't remember when the insight comes. It's probably after the Employee Free Choice Act failure, where we have 58 votes for a committed votes for an employee free. We have 60 votes for the Employee Free Choice Act, but we can't get on the floor Ted Kennedy and Byrd at the same time. And so they would have made 59 and 60. And we could get one of them on the floor, but you couldn't get them both on the floor at the same time. And you needed the 60 votes to override the filibuster, which was the blockage of consideration of the Employee Free Choice Act. Meanwhile, Cohen had been in a committee that had negotiated a watered-down version or some version lesser than what we wanted. Pelosi had passed it several times in the House. So had we gotten Byrd and Kennedy, who were both sick, on the floor at the same time, we would have changed labor law, which would have been a massive accomplishment. But because we couldn't get them on the floor, we couldn't break the filibuster, then the insight, Cohen's insight comes, well, the filibuster is undemocratic. We have to change that. So that leads us down this massive rabbit hole of Senate rules. And you couldn't pick more unlikely candidates. Well, actually, Cohen surprised me. But anyway, more unlikely candidates than Cohen or I to understand the rules that govern Senate lawmaking. And so that was a big fight. And that big fight in terms of coalition building and convincing coalition partners that this was an important way to go was a big deal, because the people who were for abortion were against it because they needed their person to be able to filibuster the move of the right wing to pass something on abortion rights. Pass something.
Opposed to abortion.
Thank you. The environmentalists on Alaska, oil drilling in Alaska, didn't want to risk that because without the filibuster, they wouldn't be able to stop oil drilling. So, and in the African American world, I don't remember whether they had to be convinced or they were more amenable to begin with. I think they were more amenable to begin with. They didn't, I guess, because the voting rights, no, but they should have been. Anyway, I'm not sure why they were more deeply involved in the coalition.
Maybe the Voting Rights Act had already been gutted.
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
I think that would have been their risk, but they somehow, it was Bongelis was the head of it, so I'm not sure what was going on. And then Common Cause at that point, Common Cause, and then Bob Edgar, former congressman from Pennsylvania, was the head of Common Cause. He came and spoke to the board at one point about why the rules were no good, but discovering individuals who were powerful, and Carl Pope was at the Sierra Club, discovering individuals who were powerful voices in making the case that Senate rules had to change was a big step forward. And after a couple of years, we did change the Senate rules, although our guys wouldn't go all the way to do the Supreme Court and left it to them. And then when they did the Supreme Court, we got screwed. But in that fight, we also ran into, I guess I ran into, what's his name? Harry Reid was the Senate Speaker from Nevada. Our local in Nevada was important to the Reid machine because we had people who could generate votes outside of in Las Vegas. So what's her name? I just blocked on her name. Our rep, anyway, was central to this process of rounding up votes outside of Nevada. And John Duran was key in Reno to get the votes. And so Reid knew that they were critical to him. So we had a way to talk to Reid through them about this. And then Reid, I'm not sure when he changed or how he changed. And it certainly wasn't just these two people. But we had a way into the office that was important for us to know what was happening. And then I ran into these two billionaires who would speak to Reed as well and would give his fundraiser millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars because dark money was not the same. And it would be, oh, yeah, we had dinner with Harry last night and blah, 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 blah. It's like, oh, this is like another world for me. But that was fun, too. Stanley Scheinbaum? Anyway, it doesn't matter. So the whole filibuster fight and then getting to the place, it was a big moment, getting to the place where they actually took the vote. And the procedural vote was someone made, the chair makes a ruling. The ruling is contested. Then they have to have a vote to overrule the chair on the ruling. And it was just, or sustain the chair on the ruling. So it was procedurally fascinating, whatever.
How about Trans-Pacific Partnership fight?
That was enormous, too. And that one, Shane Larson was critical in as well. And then...
Political director
of CWA.
No, legislative director.
Legislative director, right. And in that one, I think my role was some of the materials and some of the thinking around it, but, you know, making sure that the resources were out there. And then Shane really driving that program. And then we would kick ourselves in some ways. We think... And some of it's true. I mean, we created an environment that could elect Trump because we were so effective in terms of pillaging the Clintons and creating the atmosphere around the TPP and trade in the industrial states that he had fertile ground to plow as well. So we were effective in that work.
So another big, how did the environment, external environment change and then... Well, let's, over these 40 years of your union career.
Yeah, no, it's a long time. I mean, what is so fascinating to me, when I read something that I had written in the 80s, I'm bemoaning the fact in the 80s that the textile industry is going from 17% organized down because of the runaway shop phenomena. And the fact that, A, that there's a textile industry that's 17% organized in this country is mind-boggling. But it was that dynamic that it was newish in the 80s. I don't know, you know, it was new enough to have an impact in the 80s. And so kind of runaway shops, NAFTA, the internationalization of the economy becomes a big deal. And kind of our push down, or not our push, but America's push down on workers to work for less became omnipresent. In that period, I'm not sure, the whole social compact about unions broke down as well. So the fact that there would be permanent replacements of strikers, which was unheard of. In CWA, we had two different questions around that. One was, will they replace us? And there was an argument inside, no, we got too many people. They can't hire 10,000 people all at once. To, well, you know, depends on who they are and who's breaking the union. Maybe they could, one. And then two, Barr changed it into a thing that we don't want to be predictable. So if they know we're going to strike, no contract, no work, which our mantra in 83, 86, in some places continued to be, but there was education done that, no, if they're expecting us to strike at this time, this date, they can prepare for it, deploy their managers, and be ready for the strike. If we don't strike, just think of it, our argument went, you know, they'll have all those managers and contractors lined up, and they'll be paying them already. It's good they got a double payroll. That'll be more effective than a strike. So that we introduced, Barr introduced kind of the notion of, and supported him in that introduction, of working beyond contract, mobilization. I did read in 95, then we worked for the first time in a Verizon South contract. It went on for months.
95, it was still called Bell Atlantic South.
Yeah. Bell Atlantic South. And we end up, this is again Barr's genius, we spent 5 months at the mediation services. And then he was willing to take $7 million, which at the time was a lot, but he contrast it with, well, it's a week's worth of strike benefits, and do a massive cable TV buy, which in 95 was new, unique, and effective. And we had a sloppy contractor that was named Larry the Contractor, which was the first name of the not the CEO, but the operations guy, whose name I've forgotten, Larry something or other, was his name. It drove him nuts.
Babbio?
Larry Babbio. Could have been Babbio.
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
I think he was in the north, so.
Yeah, anyway, it was Larry somebody. Drove him nuts. And we ended up at the FMCS. I was with Barr at the FMCS, settling that and doing the numbers on that. That was a time where we tried to get them to recognize this is billions of dollars that you could save on retiree health care. I can't remember what the settlement was, but it was, you know, after that that the settlement came.
I asked big external.
Right. They were big external hops with the little ladders going down.
No, of course. That's how you experience things.
And then what's so funny to me now is that the change in regulation and deregulation and what the telephone company meant totally transformed over this period where, you know, it was this business where people took service business, monopoly regulated, right, to competitive. So the changes, and those were massive changes, as opposed to you look back at it today and it's, that's just the way companies are and behave. If you started it today, you wouldn't even recognize that the union and the people in the union and the companies went through this massive transformation. And so part of that emotional energy and energy of people that, no, we're entitled to this, coming out of that era that they were entitled to it, it helped the fight back and the fight as well. We're entitled to health care. We're entitled to this, and we're entitled to a decent standard of living was part of the reason why CWA members and CWA didn't get dragged down as quickly as some of the others. Plus, it's bigger. Plus, you can't run away. It all can't run away. But Western Electric and Western Electric Manufacturing and Bell Labs. So we had, at one point, the Merrimack Valley plant had 7,000 people working in it, and now there's nothing there. We actually ran an organizing campaign amongst engineers. These would have been outside the card check agreement, so they had to be elections. This would be in the 80s. And we had engineers who, when they saw the divestiture coming, wanted to sign up to be part of the union, one. And then two, as their jobs were changing from electromechanical engineering work to software-coded engineering work, they needed a path to get from one kind of occupation to the other kind of occupation. And I can't remember. We won. Anyway, we had three elections stacked up, and I don't remember what happened exactly. So the second big transformation was just the introduction of competition, which today is obvious, but was a big deal. And then it is true that the amount of physical craft work just plummets with plug and play, which was a new invention, right? That you could actually send out a telephone to a house, you could plug it into your own cord and it would work. It was like a big deal. Not to mention then in the 2000s, I guess, you get wireless telephone beginning to emerge. So we have, I think I looked it up, 12,000 members in 2000 in AT&T wireless formation, whatever it was called. But it goes from zero to 12,000 over a multi-year period, five, 10 year period. And long distance was still the big money maker in the telephone industry. And now, you know, no one thinks twice about a long distance call because it just doesn't exist. So the wireless technology first you had computerization, digitalization, and AT&T was not as nimble as it needed to be to become Cisco, or didn't buy Cisco instead of NCR. And then two, the amount of work is much less with all the digitalization.
And the outsourcing. So one of the things I didn't hear you say as the big picture was financialization.
But that doesn't come till later in the telecom industry.
So what does later mean?
I don't know, in the 2000s.
Okay, well, you were still there for 20 years.
Yeah, no, so it doesn't come, mm-hmm. Till much later. And it begins in U.S. West, where U.S. West was a telephone company. And then this is, you know this story better than I do. Anyway, U.S. West was a telephone company. It gets bought by a fiber optic company, long distance, razzle dazzle. I can't remember the crook who owned that one. Nacho was part of it. And then Spritzer, it was a Pritzker. Yeah, Pritzker was the other pig who, anyway. They were the razzle-dazzle part, and their finances were much better than U.S. West's finances. And the industry, the financial industry, the analyst in community somehow believed that Pritzker could buy U.S. West, and rather than the profit margin being, you know, this is audio, not visual, rather than the profit margin being made up number 10%, it'll become made up number 20%, which was just absurd on the face of it. But they were able to use leverage their ownership of fiber optic right of ways along railroad lines to buy this massive company with, you know, 25,000 people at the time, and then run it into the ground, and actually went to jail ultimately for some of the lies and things that they did.
Was this Quest?
This was Quest, yeah. This is how U.S. West became Quest. It wasn't Pritzker. That's Nacho.
Nacho's one who went to jail.
Yeah, Nacho went to jail. He was at Quest. He was U.S. West Quest. Anyway, that was the first place we saw it. And the other places we didn't see quite so much. We did see, actually, post-97, I guess, is when you get the merger period and you get the kind of divestment of wireless. So we saw wireless as the future. Pac Bell was the first company that wanted to divest its wireless business or sell it, merge it with Quest, I think, to create something. Anyway, they were going to divest it from the telephone company was the key part from our point of view. And we wanted it part of the telephone company because we wanted a place for people to move to jobs. But we could not convince PSCs, and I don't know why at this point, so this would be a major failing because it was an obvious case that we, the government, gave the telephone company the rights to build wireless. Now the telephone company is going to take their rights that we gave them to build wireless and sell it over here for billions of dollars. And we, the people, the ratepayers who created this, don't get shit out of this deal. It's just like, how could that be legal? But it was. Or we didn't hire the right. So that would be an interesting back case study if we had had the resources or... We also had an ethic that we could do it ourselves, but it'd be interesting. Was there anybody who could make, or high-powered lawyers who would make a difference in those kinds of cases at the time? I don't know, but we didn't have the resources or the mechanism to grab that money to hire those people. So that would be another financialization case where what was the telephone companies got ripped apart, and then some of it's theoretical, the way in which the wage and the numbers of technicians and people who went back and forth between companies was not mammoth numbers, but it was a notion of where they could go, and particularly on the service rep side, there should have been some. But service reps gets attacked by the frigorization of work and the outsourcing of work. And AT&T, this would go back into the 80s, was the worst of that, which is a story I can leave for another day. But you do have massive so you have that financialization is what you asked about. And then later on at AT&T, you get a series of people who come in to AT&T. You get AT&T itself trying to leverage its own resources to become some version of what it thinks the information industry is going to be. And so the purchase of TCI and then the spinning off of TCI.
The cable company.
With the cable company to Comcast. So we, the union, had our hooks into a massive part of the cable industry via AT&T, and we couldn't quite we got to a place where we had a bunch of units that had been organized, and we were, you know, inches away from a contract with them. There were some key complicated local issues in terms of, like, in the West, the cable companies, I'm making this up. Yeah, let people park at home. Whereas in the East, they had people come to work to pick up the trucks. And the West loved picking up taking their home trucks home to work. In the East, they loved, you know, the work time didn't start until you were at work and going out. And so having one consistent policy was too hard for us. That was the kind of local items that we didn't have resolved. But had we had the sufficient will, which we didn't quite have, we could have held up all of AT&T bargaining to say, no, you, the company, are going to resolve this. And, you know, here's our proposal to resolve this, but we had a proposal to resolve it. And no, we're not going to settle over here until this is solved. And we couldn't quite, the conversation always would be, the leader in charge, do you want me to hold up bargaining for 50,000 people in order to solve this potential? And my answer would be, yes, that's exactly what I want you to do. And you know, most of the time the answer would be, I'm not going to do that. But so we came this close to having a big chunk of the cable industry organized, but A, the guy who owned it, whose name I'm blocking on from Denver, do you remember his name? Malone. Was a real pig, a real libertarian, and a libertarian billionaire. So when he owned a big chunk of AT&T, which was the other thing that never played out fully, or I didn't see it play out fully, is, you know, his 10% ownership on AT&T would have had an impact on how the CEO viewed the future and viewed work. And the other thing we never could quite do that we tried to do is we, the employees, owned between 7 and 10% through employee stock ownership plans. We would have owned 7 to 10% of the company as well. And in theory, if you had a 5% interest in a company, you can control it in some ways. And that was true for Wall Street, but why it wasn't true for us or why we couldn't organize that is one of the mysteries that I never figured out either, although we did a variety of things to try and exercise that muscle and exercise that power. So the financialization, A, came late to the industry, and then I think the other forces of technology, meaning at AT&T, shutting down of all the manufacturing work in the United States, and then B, the splitting apart of the customer service rep job, which they started in the 80s, well, they started probably forever. But the key story there is the Transtech story, where in the middle 80s, they set up an independent subsidiary, which is 5,000 call service people. They hired people from different Kelly Girl at the time, different temp agencies to be the employees. So there was no way to organize the unit, and we couldn't bust that. Then later on, they spin that out, and it becomes Cincinnati
Matrix, Convergys,
Bell Information Convergys. Systems. Then it becomes Convergys, which now has 200,000 seats or three in around the world.
It's been bought. There's another name for it now.
Performance or something. But now we have actually an organizing campaign of performance with the International Federation, where we actually have a neutrality agreement. So that would be the other thing that I think, I don't know, that we're known for, that we believe, for CWA, the administrations I work with believed, was that, we were telling this whole filibuster story too. But anyway, but we believe that if you neutralized employer animus towards the union, people would organize. That it wasn't, people wanted a union, so you had to take employer animus out of the picture. So then it was getting to card check became critical, we tried different variations of that, but it was, I think, card check at the end of the day, as opposed to some people would argue about access and different things. But the people who did that work emphatically argue that it's card check that really matters.
And neutrality,
but neutrality can be written in lots of different ways. So if you just have neutrality, you don't have neutrality. And so an employer, whoever the employer is actually makes a difference in that. So at the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, for example, for a while they had a neutrality. Him and Shankman and whoever's the head of Xerox were buddies. And so they did not have, they had neutrality when Act Two organized bits and pieces of Xerox, which was amazing. So it was based on a relationship. So it was in the early 90s, when David Mintz worked for Jan Pierce and wrote a neutrality agreement
District 1
and wrote a neutrality agreement for 9X vis-a-vis the cable thing, you know, it was 3 pages of great text, but it never meant anything because the company didn't implement it. And we thought, David thought, we, CWA District 1, thought, you know, we're taking wages out of competition here, so the company shouldn't oppose us, but they did. I mean, so there's a massive ideological component, which is your neutrality thing.
Well, my last big picture question then is, how would you sum up how the union changed over the 40 years? Massive changes.
Yeah, so I think the thing I didn't really talk about in beginning in 87 or 86. Anyway, since beginning in the middle 80s, you could see convergence happening. And so you knew the convergence was going to be a big deal of some kind.
Do you mean by convergence?
We didn't have it right, but we meant communications and information services, and then information services really also means media. And so along this umbrella of technologies, both the creation of technology of content and the delivery of content, so there was were the two big elements that were coming together in some different ways. And so, and this is Morty's insight. I'm laughing because his first pronouncement when he was elected as president was, "I'm going to organize IBM." And it's like, you know, Larry, the organizing director, reads it in the paper the next day, just like everybody else. It's like, yeah, right. We never quite, we had an effort there, but we didn't never quite got IBM organized. Although amongst their professionals, in fact, there was a big deal about pensions that we worked with them on and got thousands of people signed up on a program, but we never got more than 1,000 members, I don't think. I lost track.
Your question. Massive change in the union, and you were talking about convergence.
Yeah, so convergence was a big deal. We knew it was coming. And then recognition of the different other unions that were part of that. And, you know, each one had a story. So the ITU, which was the printers union, was going down the tubes. In part, we told the story over and over again. They got guaranteed payments for their people, but their people then could be there fat and happy. And so all the work left. And that was our lesson for everybody. Just don't take care of who you got. You got to have a future too. But the Teamsters, they were going to go to the Teamsters. Donahue didn't want that to happen as the head of the treasurer of the AFL, comes to Morty and says, you should affiliate with them. So that was our first affiliation. Later on at the Jobs with Justice Convention, I think in Miami, NABIT's on strike, the broadcast technicians, bar bans NBC or somebody important from the convention. They threatened him with jail. He says, screw it. So that one was kind of, and then Jeff's guy broke his arm. Who is that? Who?
A NABIT person?
No. CWA local leader got on a fight in the picket line. Jake somebody. Anyway, his arm was in a cast. Not Sal, but somebody like Sal, but skinnier than Sal.
Oh, Joe Minow?
Joe Minow. Is that the name?
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So he
got arrested. The federal marshals arrested him.
That's who. Anyway, so maybe he didn't get his arm broken.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he was pivotal to this kind of bonding between NABIT and their identification that this guy would put himself on the line for us. So that was a bonding moment. And then once NABIT and the other one were in ITU, I think the guild of newspaper writers came. Anyway, so in terms of transformation of the union, let's go back. So first, the thing that we lost in this current era, we lost the fact that as the telephone part of the union changed, the union executive board and the union's governance structure over telephone changed. So we used to have, you know, many more districts. We consolidated them. We used to have many more national directors for different segments of the telephone industry, sales, which was equipment, installation of central office equipment, as well as regional companies. And that got merged as the industry changed. So we had lots of structural change within the telephone side of the union. And we lost then the telephone union itself and the growth of the public sector, then how is the public sector going to be represented became a flashpoint political issue. And then we have these other segments coming in that are merging with us. But what we lost in this current era, we lost the fact that we had lots of changes in the governance structure. So to make change in the governance structure today, this is not exactly your question, but it bugs me. You get people whose self-interest is in, no, I like being a vice president of CWA. Who cares that I only have 3,000 members left? I'm not going to make structural change. And our agreements are such that it made it difficult to make those changes. So one was telephone, communications conduit, and content merging. All these other unions come in. There's a story being told about that, and so that changes. The public sector grows in importance. And then the telephone side gets decimated, particularly recently, in terms of layoffs and downsizings. But throughout, we're able to unite around, or try to unite around, it's a mobilizing union, it's a fighting union, it's a democratic union. It's a union that that the different occupations that we represent are similar in one side or another, because telephone was CIO and wall-to-wall within. Well, wall-to-wall had lots of different meanings, too. Anyway, across all occupations, you had we were the biggest service rep women's union in America at one point. Public workers and around the globe, telephone workers and public workers were in the same union because of the same ethos of service, same ethos of monopoly, same lack of competition. So there was a reason why we and telephone people were alike, or we in the hospital sector were alike.
So I wanted to stick with this for a little bit, because mm-hmm. I think it's really, really deep. And other unions were not able to transform themselves. CWA did in a very challenging environment, mm-hmm. which you've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Union decline in general, technology, regulation, mm-hmm. going from being one industry to many industries, mm-hmm. going. And you can pause and think about it.
Mm-hmm.
What factors led to CWA being able to transform itself and survive?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I think the change is great. We recognized the change, and we tried to negotiate the change and stay in front of the change on the communication side. And then B, the communication side was really the backbone of the union for many years. And then there was a second backbone, which was the public worker. But they were counterbalanced in terms of the economics of the union. So when there was all this tax fights and public sector was being decimated, telephone was not. So that was a second kind of financial solid footing to it. And the other unions that came in, there was a consolidation that took place that wasn't full. And I think other unions, and it would be an interesting thing to look at, other unions, i.e. steelworkers, consolidated a bunch of unions who were manufacturing unions, and their name now is like 10 miles long with all the different elements of who they, and they would have faced similar problems, but they were not as well balanced in some ways. And then the other thing would be the auto workers, who had enormous panache and skill, also under Elizabeth Bunn, trying to organize university workers, have a substantial presence in the public sector, but didn't either auto felt, I think auto declined that much more rapidly. So the lack of economic ability for employers to take all of telephone offshore, or the threat of that, I think, provided us with an ability to stand and fight and maintain something. And then we fought all these battles about fertilization, subcontracting, and we kept the eye on. It was part of the employment security. We're entitled to jobs of the future. mentality of telephone too, that we, our eyes were on that, that, you know, I worked, my dad worked here, I worked here, my kids should work. There was a thing that I think helped us look at the future in terms of trying to preserve that. But everybody would have been trying to preserve it. But we were grounded enough in the different elements. And Watts, quite consciously, who comes out of the PTTI period, is no, we need different financial footings for the union. So that was a conscious kind of, view of how to plan for the future.